Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'd like to call a meeting of the commission to order at 9:10 a.m. on August 23, 2018. Before we proceed with our business, Carter has a statement he needs to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, a public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, just want to join y'all in welcoming everybody today. I see it's standing room only. Obviously, most of y'all are here for the special recognitions and service awards in which we're going to have a chance to recognize colleagues from all around the state and partners for their incredible service and deeds and sacrifices for our home ground. It means a lot that particularly families from all over the state and friends have come to join us today, and so thank you for making the effort to be here. I did want to just let you know a little bit about kind of meeting protocol. After we finish up that part of the morning, the chairman's going to call a quick break. Those of you who don't want to stay for the rest of the morning can be forgiven, y'all can leave the commission room, and then we'll reconvene in 5 or 10 minutes and get started with the rest of the meeting. For those of you who are staying and are here to address the commission on any of the action items that they have, I just respectfully remind you to sign up outside ahead of time, and at the appropriate time when the matter that you have an interest in comes up, the chairman will call you to come up to the podium to speak. You'll have 2 minutes or 3 minutes to address the commission about your position on that matter and just let them know your name and who you represent as part of that discussion. So we appreciate your coming today. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Following your order here. Okay. First thing we need to take up is the approval of the minutes from the commission meeting held May 24, 2018. Those minutes have been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Mr. Scott?
Second.
Second. Commissioner Jones, all in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Next item, acknowledgement of the list of donations. Those have been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Lee, second. Commissioner Latimer, all in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Okay. Next item, consideration of contracts, which have also been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Jones, second. Commissioner Latimer, all in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. So now we turn to special recognitions, retirement service awards. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We're going to kick off the morning with a new award. This is one that the commission approved, and this is the Texas Parks and Wildlife Prosecutor of the Year Award. And this is an incredibly special award in which we get to acknowledge and celebrate and honor a partner in law enforcement. Certainly all of you know that without the support of our county attorneys and district attorneys across the state, our game wardens and state park police officers can't bring cases in which they've worked so hard to present. And so having the support from the county attorneys and DAs across Texas is just hugely important. I think it's very fitting that the inaugural Texas Parks and Wildlife Prosecutor of the Year Award is going to Sabine County County Attorney Bobby Neal. Bobby's a native son of East Texas, grew up there in the woods of Sabine County, graduated from one of the local school district, went to school there at Stephen F. Austin, went to college at South Texas College of Law, practiced in private practice, and then came back in 1999 to be the county attorney for Sabine County. And nobody across the state takes more seriously the prosecution of crimes relating to fish and wildlife and trespassing and water safety and boating safety. He's an incredible supporter of our game wardens over in East Texas. The president of the Sabine County Landowners and Leaseholders Association, which is a consortium of about 400 different members of hunting clubs and landowners in that area, said, I thought pretty aptly, that any poacher over in Sabine County that is thinking about shooting a deer off the road or at night might want to think twice and might want to go ahead and think about buying the most expensive well-guided hunt in South Texas, because if Bobby Neal goes after you and he prosecutes you, it's going to be a hell of a lot cheaper to buy that hunt in South Texas. And he has just done a masterful job supporting our team in the litany of cases that he has successfully prosecuted. Remarkable. I'm going to just share some from 2017 alone. And again, if you're caught shooting a deer out of season at night, trespassing, again, violating any of our fishing game, you know, you can count on jail time, you can count on a big fine, you can count on weapons forfeiture, you can count on losing your hunting and fishing license. He really takes it seriously. Last year alone, prosecuted a poacher for shooting a turkey hen out of the off a public road out of season. Somebody from hunting deer at night from a public road in closed season. Somebody hunting deer at night, trespassing on a deer lease, trespassing with criminal mischief, hunting deer out of season. Each one of those violators got the book thrown at them. You know, the individual that made the mistake of shooting a deer at night off a public road in a closed season got 30 days in jail, fine of almost $4,000, court costs, 2 years probation with supervision fees of $65 a month, 2 years suspension of hunting and fishing license, and lost his guns. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about Sabine County Prosecutor Bobby Neal. Bobby's got his dad and his son that have come with him today to see him get celebrated by the commission chairman, also the president of the local landowners and leaseholders association. We're very, very proud of Mr. Neal and proud to honor him as the inaugural Texas Parks and Wildlife Prosecutor of the Year Award. Mr. Neal, please come forward. We've now got an opportunity to honor one of our own colleagues, Philip Wood. Philip was honored with the North American Boating Safety Law Enforcement Officer of the Year Award, a big, prestigious award across the country that recognizes officers that go above and beyond for their work in water safety and water-based enforcement. And Philip just exemplifies that in many ways. He's a 15-year game warden with Parks and Wildlife. He comes by it naturally. His late father was a game warden for the department for 20 years, I think, over in Nacogdoches County. Philip has spent his entire career over in Jasper and most recently Angelina County out of the Lufkin office. And in addition to the big woods in that part of the state, there's also big water. And so he's responsible for patrolling the Neches and the Angelina Rivers, B.A. Steinhagen, and, of course, Lake Sam Rayburn, one of the biggest lakes in the state at over, you know, 115,000, 120,000 surface acres. And Philip knows that area backwards and forwards. And so he's a game warden that gets called when boaters are lost out on the lake and they have no idea what slough or creek or oxbow or backwater creek or part of the lake that they're lost in. He's the guy to get them. When folks are out boating and drinking on the water and violating the laws, Philip is the guy to catch them. In 15 years, he's made, I think, 80 BWI cases and just done a remarkable job of helping to keep those lakes safe. He's a TCOL instructor. He's also a Marine Safety Enforcement Law Administrator trainer, and so helping to train sheriff's deputies and others on the importance of marine safety patrol out there. He works on boating accidents, some of the most horrific that you'll see in terms of kids and others that are injured as a function of drunk drivers operating boats when they shouldn't be. I could go on and on about Philip, but I want to tell you a story about what he did on April 2nd, 2016. Zach Benge, who's one of his colleagues that works in Houston County as a game warden, was patrolling the Neches River that day in his boat by himself, as he often does. And those of you who spent time over there in that river bottom know that there's a lot of stumps and a lot of obstacles, and he hit something that was submerged in the water. It threw him from the boat. He was severely injured. Leg couldn't move it. Could hardly swim. Was able to make his way over to the side of a very steep cut bank and hold on to a little stump or root coming out of the side of the riverbank. And to Zach's credit, he was doing what he was trained to do. He was wearing his PFD, his life preserver, and he had his cell phone in a waterproof pouch. And how in the world that cell phone worked down there in the bottomlands of the Neches River on that day with that tree canopy is an act of God. And for just extraordinary luck, he was able to get a little bit of a cell coverage and call Philip. And Philip was out patrolling with a civilian, was 15 river miles away. They made their way down the Neches, were able to find Zach, who was in danger of getting hypothermia and passing out in the water. They were able to pull him out of the river, apply first aid, give him clothes to keep him warm, radio in a helicopter trying to find a place to land in the woods. And that area was not easy. And they were able to get Zach out and airlifted to Tyler and save his life. And for that and many reasons, we're very, very proud to see Philip get this award today. It's a special one. I know, like all the other game wardens, he'll tell you he's just doing his job, but we're awfully proud of him. We've also got here today to honor him a couple of colleagues from Chairman Trent Ashby's office over in Lufkin, and Representative Ashby reached out the other day and wanted to make sure that his office had a chance to also thank Philip for his service back home and the district. And so we've got two of his colleagues that are here, Judd Messer and Joseph Sieber, that are going to come forward as we present these awards to Philip, and also a proclamation and a flag from Chairman Ashby. And so let's honor and thank Philip Wood. Philip, please come forward. Each year, the Midwestern Association of Fish and Game Law Enforcement Officers honor an officer as their Officer of the Year, and we could not be more proud of the fact that this year's honoree is Texas Game Warden Rob Fretz, and very fitting to see Rob get this award. I'm looking around for Rob. I thought I saw him earlier. And there you are, Rob. Rob actually received the formal award up in Bismarck, North Dakota, which was a long way to go for the award. I hope it wasn't the dead of winter, Rob. So Rob graduated from the Game Warden Academy in 2008, and he and his family moved to Brackettville, where he served the department in Kenny County. And so he worked the hill country and the brush country and the border. And I can tell you from firsthand experience and knowledge that Rob's incredibly well respected in that Kenny County community. People just love him over there. Very responsive, always the first one to volunteer for special duties. And whether it was helping his colleagues in neighboring counties on opening day of dove season, and major cases dealing with baited fields over in Frio County, or border operations, or something on Amistad or the Devil's River, Rob's always the first one to raise his hand. Just recently, Rob transferred over to Wilson County to be closer to his family, and so he's proudly serving the department in that area. And I want to tell you about an event that actually you already know about, but what you probably don't know about is Rob's role in that. It was a horrific day, Sunday morning, November 5th, 2017, at a little Baptist church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. And Rob was in the Wilson County Sheriff's Office that morning when a call came over the radio that a shooter was in the church. And without hesitation, Rob jumped in his patrol truck, met a couple of deputies from the Sheriff's Office and several officers from the Lavernia PD, and raced right into danger, just as our officers are trained to do. And there he found an unspeakable tragedy. That shooter had killed 26 people in that little country church of all ages, including entire families. The shooter was gone, and so Rob immediately transitioned from his role in law enforcement to first responder. He used all of the training that this department has given him in terms of that active law enforcement response training and first aid and trauma. Rob was pressed into service as he was trying to do triage, figure out who was alive, who needed help, putting bandages on people, applying tourniquets, carrying out a 4-year-old girl and praying for her. She's going in and out of consciousness, getting people out of the church to the medics so they could be taken for first aid. Incredible act of heroism and bravery and service, and just a remarkable act of service during an unspeakable tragedy for that community and our state. And nothing makes you prouder to have one of your own being one of the first ones to race into danger and help people and families and communities when they need it most. And Rob Fretz is that man. And we're proud this year to bring him in front of the commission to celebrate his recognition as the Midwestern Association Fish and Game Law Officer of the Year. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Fretz. Rob.
Hang on a second. Let me fix that.
We've got a couple of retirements and soon-to-be retirees that we're going to have a chance to thank for their service. And the first one is one of our fisheries biologists, Charlie Munger. And Charlie has been with us for 32 years. Some of y'all may have had a chance to meet Charlie when we were up at the commission meetings in Amarillo and Lubbock. Most recently, he's been our district fisheries biologist up in the Panhandle out of the Canyon office. And so he and his team of biologists and technicians are responsible for managing and stewarding all the lakes and rivers and reservoirs up there. And he's just done a fabulous, fabulous job. And what can oftentimes be a very challenging aquatic environment because of the lack of rain to help fill all those surface lakes and reservoirs up there. His career has taken him, you know, all over North and West Texas to Canyon and San Angelo, Abilene, spent a little time in San Marcos, and again, for the latter part of his career as our district fisheries biologist, where he's been very involved with developing that really incredible wildlife fishery up in the Panhandle. He's worked on channel cat. He's been a leader in the Professional Society of American Fisheries Society. He was the president of the Texas chapter, got their Outstanding Fisheries Biologist of the Year award. When he was president of the organization, he put together the first tri-state meeting of fisheries biologists with Arkansas and Louisiana, and emphasized the importance of working across our shared borders and shared waters. He's won many awards here at the agency and also scientific awards, contributed 17 different scientific papers to the literature, and has just really led by example. And we're awfully proud of Charlie's service and 32 years of service to Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And let's thank him for those 3 decades plus 2. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you.
Chairman, this next one, if I start to whimper like my son Ryland did when his aptly named T-ball team, the Little Monsters, got beat in the Delwood Optimus T-ball championship game and lost to the Mighty Grasshoppers, you're going to soon know why as we bid adieu to Ann Bright. And imagine a Texas Parks and Wildlife Department without a legal division, without a general counsel's office, and without a chief operating officer, because that's what we had before Ann Bright was catapulted into those positions to lead those teams. And I dare say we couldn't have chosen any better. Ann has just brought an incredible sense of acumen and experience and wisdom and wit and stability to those positions and leadership. She's just done a remarkable job. You know, she grew up on the – actually, I'm kind of nervous to say where she grew up, because if you say she grew up in the panhandle, you're going to get a quick lecture about the difference between Amarillo and Lubbock. It has it's like the Dallas and Fort Worth schism. You got to be from up there to understand. But she's a farm girl from somewhere outside of Lubbock, got wherever that is, went to school at the Intellectual and Athletic Center of the Western Hemisphere, Texas Tech University, came down here to the 40 Acres for law school at the University of Texas. She practiced in private practice for a while, was recruited by the insurance commissioner to come over and work at the Department of Insurance, and a little over 16 years ago, my predecessor, Bob Cook, and Catherine Armstrong, who was the chair at the time, talked to Ann into becoming the agency's first general counsel. And at that time, we had a few lawyers that were scattered out in divisions. We didn't have the general counsel's office established. And Ann brought that team of attorneys together, hired a number of others, and I dare say they're the most talented, committed, dedicated stable of lawyers that you're going to find in state government or many anywhere, and that is a huge testament to Ann's leadership. And if you think about the breadth of things that we've asked Ann and her team over the years to administer for the agency, of course now Bob and that team, it's remarkable, from water rights and fish and wildlife law and civil procedure and criminal law and contracts and real estate and Open Meetings Act and administrative procedures and HR law and employment law and litigation and mediation and on and on and on. Ann just did a remarkable job leading that team. As you also know, 2 years ago, I twisted her arm into becoming our inaugural chief operating officer to oversee really the administrative functions of the agency, the day-to-day operations of finance and budget and operations. She said she would do it for a year. At the end of that year, I twisted her other arm, and she said she'd stay for another year, and now we've run out of arms, apparently. She's just done a masterful job, and if you think about, you know, her time here in the last 16 years, there hadn't been a major decision that this commission hadn't made and which Ann hadn't been a part of. You know, from the onboarding for every commissioner and your training before serving this agency, to the development of the rules and regulations that you preside over to help set our fish and game laws across the state, from the acquisition of real estate to add to our parks and wildlife management areas, to the hiring of key personnel, to the handling of, you know, significant issues with litigation, and you name it, Ann has been right there in the middle of it, and her fingerprints and footprints loom large inside Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. She's just been an extraordinary public servant, the best of the best, and we thank her for this amazing career with Texas Parks and Wildlife. Ann Bright. Ann. Yeah, you ought to know how to hold it. Yeah.
One more.
All right, Stan's got the important one. Thank you, Stan. Thank you.
I want to join Carter in honoring the exceptional service that Ann's provided. In the 10 years I've been here, she has just been an invaluable resource for me and for the commission. And I hate to see her go.
Can I echo that? But let me just say this one quick thing, Carter, and I don't mean to take up all this time, but Ann's a lawyer, and what y'all don't know and what you don't get to see is that we have to go into executive session on every meeting, and y'all don't get to hear and see what we talk about. And if you know the people on this commission, we are, well, we can be a difficult lot. Let me just put it that way. That's right. And had a way of telling us no without making us feel bad. And I'm not going to disclose a bunch of attorney-client communications that went on, but let's just say Ann is formidable. So if you're going to pick a fight with somebody in this room, I wouldn't pick Ann. Just saying. But I will also say that I've been here 8 years, and lawyer to lawyer, Ann Bright's one of the best. And absolutely appreciate her service. I appreciate her advice that she's given us. She's guided us through some very, very difficult times. Some things that this department had to face that were monumental. And I know of the time that Ann spent here and with us, but I know that she took from her family and from her personal time to do things that we don't even know about. And so I just want her to know that we appreciate that and we love you for it. And if you ever need anything, you know where to come to get it. Thank you.
Well, we finally made Ann Bright blush. It took 16 years, but all right, we're going to now move on to service awards and fun to celebrate all of our colleagues who have given so much, and you said it well, Commissioner Jones, really their lives to this agency. The service is just remarkable, and this is certainly fitting as we talk about wildlife biologist Joyce Moore, who literally kind of grew up with Parks and Wildlife. Her family has had a ranch that's been in her family for well over 100 years over near that little German community of Bergheim. It borders Guadalupe River State Park. And so Joyce grew up literally right next to the park. She went off to East Texas to Stephen F. Austin. By the way, you Aggies better watch out. There's a lot more lumberjacks in this bunch than you might realize. They have quietly penetrated this agency over time. Joyce went to Stephen F. Austin and studied forestry and wildlife and came back for a short stint working for our state parks team, and then was hired as a wildlife biologist to work in South Texas in Frio and Dimmitt and Medina and Zavala counties, working with private landowners and providing technical guidance assistance to them and helping with all of our non-game and non-game related programs there. 2004, she moved back to the Hill Country so that she could be closer to her family ranch. She's responsible for operating with her son, and she lives in Harper and provides technical assistance, again, to landowners all over the Edwards Plateau. And Joyce just does a phenomenal job. She really knows her work backwards and forwards. She knows the landscapes and habitats in which she operates, the management prescriptions that she gives. She's incredibly responsive to the landowners that she works with every day. We rely on her to do so much for the wild things and wild places of our state. And I love what she said about her career, that she's worked with dozens and dozens and dozens of wildlife biologists and technicians and district leaders and regional directors and executive directors, but it's only one agency, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Joyce Moore, 35 years of service. Joyce, bravo.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for what you do. Our next colleague, Jeff Benson, who's a state game warden out of Medina County, has been with us for 30 years and proudly graduated from the academy back in 1988, first posting down in Willacy County at Raymondville and Port Mansfield, in which he got to work the Lower Laguna Madre and East Cut and the King Ranch Shoreline and Sal Vieja and Arroyo Colorado and all those really extraordinary places down in deep South Texas. Started down there for a number of years, and then Jeff moved over to San Jacinto County in East Texas, living there in Cold Spring, working the National Forest, of course, Lake Livingston and the Trinity River. That's job security for a game warden, by the way. There is a lot to say grace over in that neck of the woods, and Jeff more than earned his stripes over there. One of the things I love about Jeff is just how he's really worked on his professional development over time, and he's an instructor in just many things, including hunter ed, boater ed, master peace officer, a TCOL instructor, simmunitions, firearms instructor, less than lethal munitions, field sobriety, boat accident investigator, alert training, you name it. Jeff has been there to learn and then teach our other colleagues throughout the agency. He's now based over in Medina County. He's been very, very active over there representing us on the front lines for this agency. Throughout his career, he's represented us in a number of high-profile incidents and operations from Operation Dalmatian over in East Texas and Arrowhead in East Texas and the incident we had out in El Dorado, huge drug bust there in Menard County when the Dallas PD lost officers in that horrific shooting a number of years ago. Our game wardens and park peace officers went to Dallas to take on patrols for officers so that they could attend their colleagues' funerals and tend to families. And Jeff was one of the first ones to volunteer for that, and we're awfully proud of his 30 years of service. State game warden Jeff Benson. Jeff, bravo. Thank you. We've got another colleague from that graduating class, 30 years of service as a state game warden, Mark Collins. And Mark got out of the Game Warden Academy and went over to Woodville, Tyler County, something that our colonel knows a little bit about, and was also able to cut his teeth on that job security over in East Texas. When Mark came out of the academy, that was also the time in which the agency was winding down the hunting deer with dogs over in East Texas. And so Mark was very, very, very busy, as he likes to say, so busy that his young daughter saw him so infrequently that the only name she really knew him by was the occasional time that she heard her mom call him Mark. At some point, he thought that ought to transition to Dad. And so they moved up to the Panhandle, thinking that might be quieter. We gave him three counties as a duty station with nine hunting seasons going on at the same time up in the Panhandle. So I'm not sure that his work slowed down one bit at all. Mark's been involved in a bunch of high-profile incidents and represented this department really well throughout his career. There was a big case of four outlaws who shot six trumpeter swans up in the Panhandle. Mark made the successful apprehension of that, made national and international news for his enforcement work on that just senseless and needless tragedy. Some of you may remember that not-so-merry band, the secessionists, the Republic of Texas, that took over land out in the Davis Mountains. They had were responsible for kidnapping, abuse of a public servant, theft, all kinds of crimes. They holed up in the Davis Mountains, and the game wardens were called in to help resolve that situation. Mark was on the front lines there. The men of the Republic of Texas called Mark and his colleagues the enemies in the woods. And Mark was and his team were able to bring that to a successful standstill. When Governor Bush and his family wanted to go on a horseback ride for a couple of days here in Caprock Canyon, Mark was on horseback there to provide executive protection support for him. And so a wonderful career. I would also be remiss if I didn't say these things about Mark, too, who he and his family are now based in Canadian. And so he's got Hemp Hill and Lipscomb counties in which he very proudly serves this agency, always taking his physical fitness very seriously. He's represented the agency, really, the state, and the U.S. Police Olympics back when he was a little younger, and has a bunch of medals to show for it. He's also been a huge supporter, Clayton, of the Public Hunting Lands Program, and really one of the first game wardens to go out and actively help to acquire leases from landowners to help provide public hunting opportunities for the public up there. And I know our biologists have been very, very grateful to Mark for his service. He's gotten a bunch of awards throughout his career. It's 30 proud years of service. Let's thank Mark for this extraordinary service to Texas Parks and Wildlife. We've got another colleague from that game warden graduating class, Albert Flores, also graduated in 1988 and moved down to San Patricio County, which has been Albert's first and only duty station for the state. And so he and his family have set deep roots there. They're really part of that community. Albert is incredibly well respected as a game warden. I remember, I think it was the second time that I met Albert, maybe the third time. I was sitting in a duck blind in Corpus Christi Bay one morning with Derek Spitzer, who's a game warden for us in Northeast Texas, and we had been tasked to take the new director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service out duck hunting. And so we're freezing in this duck blind, and it's a little slow, and we're getting a few little passing shots, and there's this huge raft of ducks off in the distance that we're just staring longingly at. And just hoping that maybe those birds will get kicked up to come our way. And then out of nowhere, here comes this airboat moving towards the ducks, and they get up and start to come our way, and we think, oh, this is great. And here comes the airboat, here comes the ducks. We said, no, we can't do that, obviously. And so Derek and I put our guns down. I think we had to grab the gun of the Fish and Wildlife Service director. He was so excited about that. And so we kind of forgot about the airboat as this huge raft of ducks flew by. And as the last one went by, the airboat pulled up, and I kind of pulled down my mask, and the three individuals in the boat pulled down theirs, and Albert and his state game warden union said, good morning, how's the duck hunting going, sir? So it was always good to know that they're watching everywhere and doing their jobs. Albert is incredibly well respected. He gives back through the Saltwater Enhancement Association, DU, CCA. He's a master hunt master with the Texas Youth Hunting Program, our program with the Texas Wildlife Association, which they run. Albert also is an instructor for the Max McGraw Conservation Leaders Institute, which exposes fish and wildlife professionals in agencies to hunting and the North American model. And Albert gives very generously of his time to help teach in that regard, just does a masterful job down there on the coast. But he's quick to tell you that his proudest accomplishment is the two twins that he's got with his wife that they raised in that area. They were valedictorian and salutatorian of Ingleside High School. One of them's going on to get a postgrad degree in wildlife biology, and the other one is studying to be a speech pathologist. And we're awfully proud of Albert for his service to the state. 30 years of service. Albert, thank you. One more. This is an important one.
Here.
Yeah, right. Like most of our field colleagues, you guys do a good job of avoiding Austin.
Sorry.
Thank you. Our next colleague may have the most familiar voice of all to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission, Ted Hollingsworth. Ted has been with us, this is remarkable, 25 years. Ted is a wildlife biologist by training, got both his undergrad graduate degree and his graduate degree from Texas A&M. God, it's getting quieter. It really is. It's just this little whimper that's coming out. Proud graduate of, that's right, the Lumberjacks are certainly not cheering him on. Ted has really had a remarkable career. He was a museum director for 10 years, and sometime you need to get Ted to tell you some of the stories from his day there. We went and recruited him and as a natural resource specialist and wildlife biologist working for the State Parks Division at San Jacinto, and Ted really led our inaugural natural resource restoration plans on the upper coast on our parks. And so all the efforts to restore the landscape of the battleground at San Jacinto, that was Ted Hollingsworth's handiwork. And working on native prairie restoration and marsh restoration and restoration of Mima mounds and helping to provide interpretive trails and so forth, just did a phenomenal job. Ted was recruited by Jack Bauer to move to Austin in 2004 to work in the land conservation program, and he's been our director of that since 2007, and obviously has had a lot of interaction with this commission as he and his team have helped with the acquisition and addition of lands in our wildlife management areas and state parks and coastal fish hatcheries, worked on easements and all kinds of important land issues. I was looking at some stats during Ted's tenure in the land conservation program, in which he and his colleagues have helped protect and add over 90,000 acres to our public land system in that just short 10-year period. And he's been involved with the Palo Pinto Mountain State Park and the Powderhorn WMA and State Park, the Roger Fawcett Wildlife Management Area, Yoakum Dunes, Devil's River, the Fortress Cliffs, additions at Big Bend Ranch, Lost Maples, the Matagorda Peninsula, and the list goes on and on. Ted Hollingsworth has done a bunch for conservation in this state. We're awfully proud of his 25 years of service. Ted, thank you. Our next colleague, and I started about the same time, Robert Perez. Robert, 25 years of service to Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, started out as an intern at the Kerr Wildlife Management Area, and then while he was working on his master's degree at Texas State, he was involved in a quail research project at the El Coyote Ranch and down at the Chaparral Wildlife Management Area. Was hired as a seasonal employee for the department in 94, working with our upland ecology and game bird program for the late Don Wilson, who I know was just an extraordinary mentor for Robert. Don passed away recently and just was a very, very gifted individual and intellectual who gave a lot to this department, and Robert had the privilege of training under him. Robert did everything Don didn't want to do. CITES compliance, Bobcat tags, late Pittman-Robertson reports. When there was some place to travel, Robert was sent on the road, sometimes with Don, sometimes without. The adventure was always with Don. Let me assure you of that. For those of you who knew Don Wilson, and Robert was the go-to guy to get things done. He transferred down to South Texas as a wildlife biologist later on in the 90s, where he worked down in Wilson and Karnes counties working with private landowners on various wildlife-related things, and that's where he got his nickname from the South Texas team that called him Sheeble, the goat, because he would eat anything and everything. And words to the wise about spending any time with the wildlife biologists of this agency. If they offer you anything having to do with critter stew, if you insist on eating it, don't ask what's in it unless you're interested in pocket mice and, you know, gophers and hispid cotton rats and all other small mammals that add a little bit to the potatoes and carrots in the stew. Robert came back to Austin, fittingly, in our upland ecology program and became the first state's first quail leader working across Texas as we really began to prioritize our work on quail research and conservation and habitat, became our upland game bird leader, and Robert has been really active on pheasant work, turkey work, and quail work, and upland game bird, non-game habitat work, and just done a great job. He and his wife have got two wonderful kids, and he's given us 25 years of proud service. So, Robert Perez. Robert, thank you. This next colleague, I'll confess, I was looking at it this morning. I thought, who is Mary Parker? And that is Melissa Parker, by the way, for those of you who have met Melissa. And you won't forget her if you meet her. She just got this wonderful, engaging personality. And Melissa has been a biologist with us for 25 years. She started out over in the woods of East Texas as an endangered species biologist. She moved to Austin a few years later to work with our habitat conservation branch here in Austin, and then transferred offices there to San Marcos. And what I'll say about Melissa, and I know that Commissioner Jones would speak to this if he was here, if there is a high-profile project that's sensitive, that involves stakeholders with divergent and dissenting views, and you want the one person on the planet that can pull them all together and keep people in a room and keep them talking and get people to participate and engage to try to find a solution to what otherwise has been an intractable problem, you call Melissa Parker. She was the one that everybody turned to create the first habitat conservation plan for red-cockaded woodpeckers in East Texas when the foresters wanted to gut shoot the environmentalists, and the environmentalists wanted to keep the timber companies from cutting down any trees and save the red-cockaded woodpecker, and Parks and Wildlife was in the middle of it. Melissa was there to help mediate between all of those parties to put together a conservation plan. When it became clear that all of the trespassing and off-road traffic down in the state's river bottoms and beds were causing a lot of ecological damage, Bob Sweeney and Melissa Parker were the ones that the state turned to help work with stakeholders and work with the legislature to develop legislation to keep people out of the state's river beds. When Phil Montgomery, who served on this commission, certainly you remember Phil very well, Chairman, wanted to create the paddling trails. Melissa Parker was the one to work alongside Phil to help launch that program. The issue with the incompatible uses and conflicts on the San Marcos River, Commissioner Scott over at Martindale, we tapped Melissa to work with Bob Sweeney and Commissioner Jones on a stakeholder process. And right now we have her leading one over in the Frio River over conflicts on sand and gravel mining in the Frio River. River. And again, Melissa just does a masterful job of bringing people together, disarming folks, breaking down barriers, and helping to advance fish and wildlife conservation every day. She does a terrific job. Melissa Parker, 25 years of service. Bravo. Our next colleague, also from our inland fisheries team, Kareem Aziz, 25 years of service. One of our fisheries biologists, started off as an intern for our coastal resource team, then under resource protection, and really showed a lot of biological acumen and skills, moved over to our river studies program as a full-time biologist for us out of our San Marcos office. And Kareem has been involved with the survey and monitoring and mapping work of literally every watershed, river, spring, stream, creek, river in the state, and has just given us so much more information about these richly important water bodies in the state and their fisheries habitat and fisheries composition and how best to manage them. He also brings a lot of important kind of landscape ecology or GIS related skills. And I read this, and Chairman, this is a great honor. You're going to love this. In 2017, Kareem was honored at the big Esri user conference out in California. Esri, of course, is the company that makes all of the software for the GIS-related platforms. And Kareem was honored with a special achievement in the application of geographic information systems for his innovative work developing a floodplain inundation model to define the characteristics of floodplain related events to facilitate successful spawning of alligator gar on the Middle Trinity. And so it was pretty cool to see him recognized at a conference like that for the work that he's doing for this department. He's done great work for the fisheries, big and small, of this state and every water body, and we're awfully proud of his 25 years of service. Let's thank Kareem Aziz. Kareem, bravo. Our next colleague out of our coastal fisheries team, Dale Shively. Dale has sunk more ships than any naval admiral or captain you'll ever meet. Dale may have the coolest job inside Parks and Wildlife in terms of what he gets paid to do every day. Dale's been with us for 25 years, started out as a biologist up in Galveston Bay out of the Dickinson office, and then moved to Austin to be an assistant to our coastal fisheries deputy, I guess Lance at the time, transitioned over the artificial reef program and has become its director, and has been for a long time. And so Dale is the one that is out there working on that rigs to reef related program with oil companies as they're decommissioning reefs out in the rigs out in the Gulf, and Dale works with them to leave those pilings and jackets there in the water or move them to reef areas because they provide such important deep water structure and habitat for our coastal fisheries, amazing ecosystems. The companies save money because they don't have to remove all of those legs and pilings from the water, which also causes a huge amount of disturbance, by the way, and part of those savings then are donated back to the department in the artificial reef program. So that then we can go create more habitat out in the bays and the Gulf. And that's Dale's bailiwick, he and his teams. And they pioneered a lot of other artificial reef block-related techniques. He's got a great project going on now with CCA and Shell Oil for the first $1 million reef off of Port O'Connor. I think Dale and his team have sunk upwards of 17 ships or so during their career, like the Clipper and the famous Kraken from you remember your, I guess, what, Greek mythology? What was that, Josh? Okay. All right. Go with me. That mythical sea monster that the ship was named after off of off Galveston, and you know, Dale occasionally gets to swim with sharks and red snapper, and see the handiwork that he and his team do every day to improve our coastal habitats for fishing and diving and so forth, and tourism. Just does a great job. 25 years of service, Dale Shavitt. Dale, bravo. You know, sometimes God works in mysterious ways, and a blind hog will find an acorn. And one morning early, I was coming into the office, and I couldn't believe it. There were lights and cameras, like these movie trucks, people in black kind of running out the front door that were kind of like stage people or creative people, and I thought, this is great. I'm walking into an episode of Lone Star Law right here. I thought, I'm going to get to meet Ellis Powell. And, well, it wasn't Ellis, but there was Clayton Wolf right in the middle of a photo shoot for the Texas Trophy Hunters. And I got to watch Clayton pose as reflective Clayton, as conversational Clayton. Some of his elk hunting buddies dragged up some old shed elk antlers, and they put him out in the yard back there, and Clayton posed with him, acting like he'd shot an elk. It was really big time, and learned a lot about Clayton in the article. I forgot it. I've got it somewhere, but I'll send a picture around. I suspect the Wildlife Division staff has seen it by now, Clayton. Craig Bonds, and I don't think this is true, Craig swore up and down there was a makeup artist there when that was being filmed. I don't think so, Clayton, really, to be fair. Clayton, in all seriousness, 25 years of service to this agency, started out as a biologist for Temple Inland, came to the department as our district leader over in East Texas for the Piney Woods. And Clayton led our efforts on eastern turkey restocking, did all the breeding chronology-related work, the establishment of an either-sex deer season, an open season for muzzleloader. Clayton, because of his expertise, was promoted to our whitetail deer program leader, later our big game program director, overseeing the work with antelope and mule deer and bighorn sheep and whitetail deer and mule deer all over the state. And then, of course, in 2009, Clayton became the director of our wildlife division, where he leads an extraordinarily talented team of men and women across Texas that do just wonderful things for our home ground. And I think about the accomplishments, Clayton, of you and your team under your leadership, and the, you know, 30-plus million acres of land that are under wildlife management plans, thanks to the work of your team, the acquisition of the new Yoakum Dunes Wildlife Management Area, and the Fawcett WMA, and the Cross Timbers, and the Powderhorn at the Wildlife Management Area, the increase in the public hunting-related opportunities, the restoration of pronghorn antelope with our partners at BRI and the ranchers out in West Texas, and bringing sheep back to the mountains of West Texas. It's just been remarkable with that team accomplishments on everything, again, from, you know, bighorn sheep to horned lizards, the work with the Recovering America's Wildlife Act that you've been very supportive of, Clayton, and just done a terrific job leading this department, also through some very, very difficult times. As you know, Clayton has been our point person on all of the chronic wasting disease related issues, which I can assure you ain't been much fun. And I oftentimes joke that Clayton may have the hardest job in the agency, with 4.5 million deer in the state and 4.5 million opinions about how they ought to be managed. And Clayton manages all of that with great professionalism and leadership, and awfully proud of all of that. 25 years of service. Clayton Wolf. Bravo, Clayton.
Did you have a makeup artist?
No, not this time.
Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, Rob. our next colleague, Brenda Coppedge, 20 years of service. And I'll tell you, if you want to reach somebody at Parks and Wildlife at headquarters at 545, don't call Josh, but you can call Brenda Coppedge. She's the first one here to turn on the lights and turn on the coffee pot. She's an accountant with our financial resources related team, and just done a great, great job over the years as part of our accounts payable team. And so for all of our colleagues inside Parks and Wildlife, I mean, the things under Brenda's purview are impressive. She handles all of the grants for land acquisition related payments. If we've got any kind of purchases related to vehicles, boats, trailers, or ATVs, Brenda is the one responsible for that. Repairs and inspections of vehicles, workers' comp related payments, legal settlements. You need help on accounts payable, Brenda is the one that you call. And she's just been extraordinarily committed to this agency while raising two kids as a single mom. She loves to fish. She loves the mission, just lives and breathes it, and just does a wonderful, wonderful job serving Parks and Wildlife and the men and women who work here and the people that we serve. And let's celebrate her 20 years of service to this agency, Brenda Coppedge. Brenda, bravo. Thank you. Our next colleague has also been here for 20 years, Don Cash. Don is part of our communications team. I think we poached Don from Mississippi and got him here as soon as we could. Don has just done a remarkable job as one of our producers of the TV show. He's just one of our creative geniuses and master storytellers, responsible for producing those, again, just fabulous TV shows that you see that the department produce on PBS and TV stations and social media channels, just all over the web. During Don's career, he has helped produce and put together 520 shows, almost 200 individual segments, again, helping to tell the amazing stories about Texas and the places and things that we steward and the people that work here. 2002, Don was promoted to series producer, which he likes to call lower mid-level management. Don ain't much for administration, I'll tell you that. Don is much, though, on producing extraordinary shows. He is responsible for figuring out what the content is, arranging all the filming, lining people up, the production, the editing, the storytelling, the distribution to all the channels around the state that show the PBS show, getting them on news channels around the state, posting them on social media stuff. And I'll tell you, his handiwork has been recognized over and over throughout his career. He's been part of a team that's been recognized for 14 Lone Star Awards, 23 Association of Conservation Information Awards, and 4 Lone Star Emmys. And today we thank him for 20 years of service. Bravo, Don. 20 years. Thank you, Don. You knew that was coming, didn't you? All right, Dave's got one.
Okay, Dad. Be closer.
Our next big colleague, Stephen Lang, one of our wildlife biologists and regional directors over in East Texas, has been with us 20 years. And Stephen grew up over in Mesquite, east of Dallas. And the thing I love about Stephen's background is he grew up a public lands hunter and angler. And so he used the old Type 2 wildlife management areas, hunted the old Temple Inland properties that we had leased for years, and just fell in love with the outdoors. As Stephen likes to say, he owned 3 boats before he owned a truck that could pull any one of them. But by golly, he was going to be ready to go when that truck came. He took that passion to A&M Commerce, where he got his bachelor's in master's degree and volunteered for the department at the Cooper Lake Wildlife Management Area in Old Sabine Bottom and developed a lot of relationships inside the department. Went to work for the Corps of Engineers for a few years before he was hired back with the department as a biologist to work at none other than Old Sabine Bottom, where he had volunteered while he was in school. Stephen went back to school to develop his skills in GIS and was given an opportunity to kind of lead a landscape GIS-related program for our East Texas team. Then he went down to South Texas to head up the wildlife management area complex that includes the Chaparral Wildlife Management Area and the Daughtry. And so Stephen was really on the front lines for all of that initial Eagleford Shale-related conversation and development there, and very instrumental in providing information for this commission about how we manage and balance oil and gas-related development and in use on our wildlife management areas, particularly our flagship ones such as the Chaparral. And Stephen just did a terrific job, recently promoted to our regional director back in Tyler, where he and his wife live close to their kids and a couple of grandkids. We're awfully proud of his 20 years of service helping to protect our wildlife and supporting our hunters and public lands. 20 years of service. Stephen, thank you for all you do. Our next colleague, Darcy Bontempo, also with our communications team like Don. Darcy came to us after a pretty distinguished career in advertising and marketing for GSD&M and McCann Erickson, and decided she wanted to pursue the public service route and bring in those creative skill sets to the department, which she has in spades. And Darcy is responsible of leading a team under Josh of our marketing and advertising related professionals, and just does some extraordinary things. One of her first big projects was the Big Time Texas Hunts and the big email campaign, which just is a phenomenal story about how she and her team are able to increase revenue for the department and her wildlife division through that effort. Any of the big branding and marketing campaigns that the department has had, Darcy has played a major role in it, from the tagline of Life's Better Outside to the invasive and exotic species related campaigns on the Clean, Drain, and Dry and the Giant Salvinia Man. She's worked on the conservation license plates, the horned lizard plate, and the others, developing the Texas conservation passport for state parks, the rebranding and relaunch of the Toyota Share Lunker program. Again, she just brought that marketing genius to the agency and really helped to get our word out. She's also brought some important skill sets and analytics and helping us think more deeply about our customers and what they want from us. And she led the first comprehensive survey of state park users to get a sense of really what were those features and amenities on state parks that were most important to them when they come to a park. She also launched the first focus group to really get a better sense of what Hispanic families are interested in when they come to the parks, and what are the amenities and infrastructure that they want to see as they come. She leads a terrific and talented team, and we're awfully proud of her 20 years of service. 20 years. Darcy, thank you. Our next colleague, also from communications, 20 years of service, Heidi Rayo, with our Hunter Ed team. And Heidi just does a masterful job representing us out of the Houston area is our hunter ed instructor. She's responsible for training all of our hunter ed instructors and doing outreach in that particular area of the state. And you cannot go to Houston and talk to a fish and wildlife organization, a conservation organization, somebody doing something with the outdoors, and every one of them knows Heidi, because Heidi has spent the better part of, you know, multiple days and weekends helping to support whatever event and outreach that they have going on in that area. She literally is everywhere. In fact, some oil companies have valued her hunter ed instruction so much that they have flown her out to the rigs to teach hunter ed out to the workers on the rigs, and that's a good thing, so that those country boys from Louisiana will learn the rules of the road, Commissioner. And so Heidi will go anywhere to help carry our message. She's developed some terrific partnerships with the city of Houston, launched this Outdoors Houston related program to get kids and families into the outdoors, a big event that attracts thousands of people to come learn about nature and conservation and outdoor recreation. She's also the director of our, or coordinator for our Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, which we're going to celebrate 25 years of that really valuable and transformational program in terms of targeting women that have an interest in getting out and fishing and hunting and camping and kayaking. And Heidi just does a great job. She's a wonderful ambassador for Parks and Wildlife, and we're proud to celebrate her 20 years of service. Heidi Rayo. Heidi, bravo. Perry, you've been awfully patient back there. This is the last one, Perry Trial. Perry is one of our biologists, and he's our regional director on the coast for coastal fisheries. And Perry was in Austin recently for a team award in which we recognize Perry and his group out of the Rockport area for their incredible resilience and response to Hurricane Harvey. Would love to show this commission that video sometime of just what an amazing job that they did after that storm. And a big part of that was Perry's leadership. Perry's a proud Texas Aggie. I'm going to give you another chance. A little better. You're getting better. Graduated with his degrees in fisheries. It's really concerned me. It's just kind of a little whimper every time I mention A&M. I just need to pick up the pace. Got a fisheries biology degree there, went to work as a biologist for us in the lower Laguna Madre, transferred back up to the upper Laguna Madre, then became our ecosystem team leader for Corpus Christi Bay. And in that capacity, and remember how our coastal fisheries team is organized around these bay systems, and they're out there all the time collecting biological data, surveying the fisheries, surveying the anglers, so that they're generating the best possible information for the commission on your decisions. And Perry has been front and center of that for his career. He was promoted to our regional director for the lower coast, and basically covers that Rockport area all the way south to Brownsville. And Perry and his team have been in the middle of all of these important issues that the commission has dealt with on fisheries, from the extending the 5-trout bag limits to how do we protect seagrass from prop scarring, what are we going to do about red snapper to ensure that we're stewarding those stocks and making sure that we've got sufficient angler opportunity, protecting oyster reefs. Perry and his team have been on the front lines of that, and we're awfully grateful for his very quiet and steady leadership down there in South Texas and on the coast. We're proud to celebrate his 20 years of service today. Perry Trial. Perry, bravo. Thank you. Chairman, Commissioners, that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Before we move on, I just want to follow up on Commissioner Jones' comments about Ann and say again how grateful this commission and predecessor commissioners are for the support that you've provided us and provided to Carter as COO. And you've always done it with exceptional professionalism and competence. And I just want to thank you again. Okay. We're obviously going to move on to more of a business component. If anybody wants to leave at this time, it'd be a good opportunity to do so. So we'll take a couple of minutes here to let people leave who wish to leave before we begin our other business. I'd like to call the meeting back to order at 10:35 a.m. Before we move forward, I want to say that agenda items 2, approval of the Department TPW fiscal year 2019 internal audit plan, and agenda item 9, disposition of land, Blanco County, have been withdrawn and will not be considered today. So we'll start with action item 1, a financial overview, fiscal year 2019 operating and capital budget approval, budget and investment policy resolutions. Mike Jensen, welcome, Mike.
Morning, Chairman Duggins, Commissioners.
Morning.
This will be a fairly quick presentation. I think many of you are familiar with this format, since both of you have been serving for a while. This slide here is kind of like the outline of what we're going to handle quickly today. The first 4 bullets tied to your exhibits A, B, C, and D. Exhibit A is the budget by strategy, B is your operating budget by division, and C is the budget policy, and D is the investment policy. And the last slide that we're going to have will be a proposed motion for consideration. The crosswalk ties to the penny to what's in this big book here. This is what they call the fiscal size-up of the General Appropriation Act. Last year when we met, we were dealing with a conference committee. They hadn't yet published this book. So what they do after the first 4 months or so after session, they true everything up. We had some contingency provisions in Article 9. So now those items have been moved into our base. So you'll see that the adjustments are really, there aren't any. We're tying exactly to the fiscal size of that bill. We have $344.5 million in our base budget. So if you went to our bill pattern, you'd come to this fiscal year, you'd scroll down, and you'd see that exact figure. We also have an estimated $74.52 million in fringe that is for employee benefit and benefit costs. Just to remind you, our base budget, it's really the net of a whole bunch of things. 2 years ago, we submitted an LAR. We had the conference committee, and we had a base at 96%, so we had a 4% cut. They had some other reductions, and they zeroed out our UB, and they gave us $79 million of exceptional request items. All that stuff got netted together with 3 contingency items. Carter mentioned 2 of them yesterday, and one of them was the lifetime license endowment. This fiscal year and this biennium, we have opportunity to spend $8 million out of an endowment. All of that has been included and is reflected in Article 6 in the fiscal size-up, true-up version of the bill. So our budget is $419.02 for fiscal year 2019. And the method of finance, if you look at this, this would tie to your Exhibit A, page 111 in your books, the method of finance. What this is, if you look at the bill pattern, it's the base bill pattern, these different pieces of the pie, and we've spread the fringe cost of 74.52 across each one of those categories. So you can see the largest one is general revenue, and that's predominantly sporting goods sales tax, unclaimed refund of motor boat fuel tax. Moving on to the operating summaries, this ties to your Exhibit B on page 113 of your book. You can see that each row that's on this slide corresponds to a column on your exhibit. So you can see salaries comprise about 41% of our budget, operating is 23%, grants about 6%, capital budget is 12%, and fringe benefits are 18%. And the Exhibit B has a little bit more detail. It also breaks this budget down by divisions and capital groupings. I'm not going to go through each line on here. You have the exhibit to look at, but you can see that one thing I want to bring to your attention is the FTEs. This is not necessarily the cap that ties that we have a cap figure in the General Appropriation Act. But this, we sometimes budget above the cap, knowing that there's going to be some retirements and some attrition throughout the year. In Article 9, this is in the back of this book that applies to all state agencies, it has a provision that allows us a plus 50 above our FTE cap. Basically, it's the lesser of 10% of our cap or 50. And because of the size of our agency, it's plus 50, because you can see our cap from 2019 is 3,146.2 FTEs. And last year, or the current year that we're closing out, was three more, because they gave us six during the legislative session for the CAPS project. We implemented last month a personnel payroll system. And when we start 2019, three of the FTEs that were approved will drop off, because we needed those just to implement that project. So if you look backwards, last biennium, our cap was 3,143.2. And before that, it was 3,109.2. So we've grown a little bit based on our exceptional request needs the past two sessions. We do have a department called department-wide, which handles, it's kind of a clearinghouse for all the divisions. In the past, you may have seen more lines. That's because we have a new division on that slide, and there was a support resources division. Some of the placeholder items that used to be in department-wide are managed by support resources. That's Scott Stover's division. The storm payment that we used to have was, it used to be budgeted within department-wide, is now budgeted in his division. And some of the lease costs that we have for the Airport Commerce Building used to be in department-wide. They're now in his support resources budget. So the first line item on there ties to our rider number 12 that gives us flexibility for payments to licensed system agents and vendors and to tax assessor collectors for boat sales, titling and registration, $6,956,000. The second item is debt service. This relates to revenue bonds for state parks, 1998 to 2003 revenue bonds. Three, you can see it's a negative. Basically, we are pre-budgeting some salary lapse for the state parks division. We did that as well last fiscal year. And as we move into the LAR, we've made a lot of adjustments to the base so that we won't have to do that in the future. The fourth item is a pass-through plates. It's roughly about six different plates of $149,000. And in the CAPS HR, the remainder that was budgeted for that project, there's still some modules to implement. About $150,000 is there. And we hold our federal apportionment in department-wide until the actual apportionments come in. $31.68 million is being held there. Capital budget is on page, again, Exhibit B-113 of your books. And this ties to, in this appropriation bill, every state agency has what they call as a rider number two. And our rider number two has several parts to it. It has paragraphs A all the way through H. So each one of these lines represents one of those subparagraphs. Construction of major repairs is paragraph A. It ties directly to what's in the General Appropriation Act. Paragraph B is parks minor repair. C and G is for IT and the data center. Transportation item is paragraph D, capital equipment is paragraph E, master lease is paragraph F, and CAPS HR is H. We have a zero amount for capital land acquisition because you're aware that we were given the lifetime license endowment of $8 million. Our intention, and you approved, was $500,000 of that would be made available for land acquisition at the Caddo Lake area. So there may be a need as we move into the next fiscal year. You'll probably see it in January, some UB from 2018 monies that will move forward. But we don't know what those are going to be until we close out the year, and it usually takes a couple months before we move those monies forward. So within a biennium, we do have UB authority. So this amount in the rider is $50.36 million for capital. The budget policy, this really has remained unchanged since about 2012. Basically, any adjustment greater than $250,000 has to be approved by the chair, a vice chair, or commission designee. And any donations or gifts exceeding $500 are approved by the commission, and they're acknowledged at every commission meeting that we have. And basically, funds are authorized for any use permitted by statute or rule. And there are no adjustments to this commission policy. Exhibit D is the same thing, investment policy. All of our monies are held within the state treasury. So the purpose of this policy is, in the event any monies are ever held outside the treasury, we'd have these retirements of the public fund investment that would kick into play, and the executive director would have to identify an investment officer, and we'd have to follow the statutory rules. Additionally, last legislative session, Article 9 provision, there is a reporting requirement for other agencies who have money outside the Treasury, there's a whole slew of reports that would have to be presented to state oversight. But because all of our money is in the Treasury, we really don't have to follow those provisions. Last year, we talked about a number of statutory changes that improved the outlook for our General Fund 9, and this was one of them, House Bill 448. It gives the commission the flexibility with boat titling registration sales tax revenues that come in. We can transfer anywhere from 0 to 15% each month into the state park account. But because the General Fund 9 was looking poor about 2 years ago, we recommended that we retain all of those revenues within Fund 9, and we're going to continue with that recommendation for fiscal year 2019. The projected fund balances for the state park account 64 at the end of August of next year is approximately $35 million. And the projected fund balances, assuming we keep the $3 million of boat revenue in Fund 9 for Fund 9, will be about $15.4 million. We do have built within our LAR a number of items that would spend some cash balances down of the state park account and the Fund 9 account. So if everything was granted to us, what Carter presented yesterday, we'd have almost $20 million of state park account is being requested for exceptional items in the LAR, and a little under $3 million of General Fund 9 is being requested for exceptional request items in the LAR.
Mike, before you move forward, can you remind us how much money is in the state park account now that's dedicated for parks, but the legislature has not appropriated any of those funds for us to use? What is the approximate amount?
I'll give you the exact. I have it written over. The biennial revenue estimate was $333.5 million. 94% of that would be $313.5 million had they appropriated that. But what they appropriated to us was $277.6 million. And so basically we were given about 88.5%.
I'm just saying, what's the amount in the account now that's unappropriated state park funds?
Mike, he's talking about the Fund 64 account. How much do we have? Do we have 40 or 45 million in that account?
Right now we have approximately 36 million. And the projected balance at the end of next year is roughly in that area.
So it's currently 36, or is that taking into account our projected LAR?
No, just as of right now, at the end of this year, the $35.96 million in account 64, state park account.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think I'd mentioned what it will be if we continue to keep the boat revenue. At the end of next year, it's projected to be about $34.8 million. And that's pretty much all I have for you today. I can read this recommended motion into the record for your consideration. The executive director is authorized to expend funds to operate the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department in accordance with the proposed fiscal year 2019 operating and capital budget, including funds budgeted from the conservation and capital accounts, Exhibits A and B, the budget policy, Exhibit C, and the investment policy, Exhibit D. The commission also approves retaining 100% of all boat registration title and sales tax revenue collected during fiscal year 2019 in Fund 9.
Members, any questions or comments? I don't show that anyone has signed up to speak, but is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak on this item? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion for approval. Commissioner Lee, second. Commissioner Jones, all in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Thank you, Mike. Item two, as I previously stated, has been withdrawn, and would expect that will be placed on the November meeting agenda. So we'll now take up action item three, commercial turtle harvest rules, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Meredith Longoria. Welcome, Meredith.
Good morning, Chairman Duggins, commissioners. I should probably lower this a bit. For the record, my name is Meredith Longoria, non-game and rare species program leader within the Wildlife Diversity Program. Yesterday, I presented in detail about the proposed rule regarding commercial collection of freshwater turtles and today I'll provide a brief recap of this action item. As you may know, market hunting and unregulated commercial exploitation devastated wildlife populations in North America in the 1800s. This led to the development of the public trust doctrine and the North American wildlife conservation model. The public trust doctrine establishes a trustee relationship with state government to hold and manage wildlife, fish, and waterways for the benefit of the resources and the public, which is an essential function of the North American conservation model. A pillar of the North American model is the concept that wildlife is a public trust resource to be managed by state wildlife agencies in a way that sustains populations in perpetuity, and that science is a proper tool for developing and employing wildlife policy in order to do so. Commercial exploitation of freshwater turtle populations runs contrary to the public trust doctrine, the North American model, and our TPWD mission. As you may recall from yesterday, in 2007, the Commission adopted the current rules which prohibit commercial collection of all freshwater turtles from public waters, with the exception of common snapping turtle, red-eared slider, and the smooth and spiny softshell turtles, which can currently be commercially collected from private waters. Since that rule was adopted, TPWD funded research to examine the efficacy of those rules in protecting freshwater turtle populations from overharvest. We found that turtle populations are extremely sensitive to commercial harvest. Even modest commercial harvest can lead to long-term declines. Public water bodies in Texas are not a sufficient source for repopulating overharvested private waters, and illegal commercial harvest continues to be a large threat. As was described yesterday, these are the biological reasons that make freshwater turtle populations vulnerable to overharvest. You may also recall from yesterday that turtle populations face multiple additional threats, including environmental threats such as water pollution, road mortality and habitat loss, depredation, and failure to discriminate among species with similarity of appearance. Data reported by non-game dealer permittees suggested that no significant economic impact on rural communities or on communities, period, should be anticipated from the proposed rule change. The proposed rule was published in the Texas Register on April 20th for public review and comment, and as of yesterday, we received a total of 1,184 comments. Of those who commented, over 98% agreed with the rule, and less than 2% disagreed completely or with a specific part of the proposed rule. At this time, staff requests that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt amendments to subsection 65.328 and 65.331 concerning commercial non-game permits, with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in April 20th, 2018 issue of the Texas Register.
Thank you, Meredith. Commissioners, any questions? All right, we have several people who have filled out forms to speak in connection with this proposed rule change, and so we'll start with Richard McNabb to be followed by Mike Forstner. So, Mr. McNabb, please present your remarks.
Good morning, Commissioners and Chairman Duggins. I'd like to take 3 minutes of your time to provide 6 reasons why I would like for you to oppose this proposal that criminalizes the commercial breeding of 4 of the most common turtles in America. This proposed rule destroys turtle aquaculture, that multiplies specimens for people to enjoy, and that have long been used in Head Start programs. These 4 hardy species often are destroyed by landowners because they are predating their fish. Farming creates more turtles for people to obtain and more red tape penders, which does not make sense in a conservation perspective. The proposed rule frustrates the ability to easily acquire and have hands-on contact with turtles, which we need to protect so our kids early on may develop interest in nature and wildlife. This proposed rule does not address how these species may mature in as little as 5 years, in the hot Texas climate. They can lay 10 to 30 eggs per year, and there was a 1994 study suggested delayed sexual maturity, but this study was conducted at the Canadian border, where everything matures much slower. The proposed rule states populations are abundant in Texas, with little to no harvest in the last decade, and it has no data showing depletions of the wild anywhere in the U.S. This proposed rule was petitioned by Californians, anti-pet turtles, trade extremists, and use an outdated, sensationalized information like Asian turtle consumption crisis, where many people think from the 1990s they were made to believe that our turtles are illegally smuggled to Asian countries and consumed. I think it would be easy to check wildlife citations to find out how many people are illegally arrested for going out and collecting these turtles. I've been in the field my whole life. I've never seen an Asian person in the field trying to collect a turtle. China, one of the Asian countries that has been said to come over and smuggle our turtles, is aqua farming their own turtles. The cry of black market and endangered crisis has led organizations to create a myth that these four common turtles are in danger. Please strike, or at least table the proposal, and continue protecting the ability for people to easily breed and enjoy these common pet turtles. Thank you. Thank you for the 3 minutes that you offered me.
Before you step down, yes, may I ask you to tell us again which specific use you believe will be precluded by the proposed rule?
I feel that there is always a need to conserve what we have in the wild. I think proposing a regulation that runs to an extreme and makes any commercial farming, the farming operation, you know, there's been wildlife agencies that go to farmers and have asked them for their breeding stock to supplement back into the wild. There is a need for captive breeding. They supply animals to the pet trade. They supply animals to people that would like to enjoy them. And without them, there would be an increase in the illegal collection. I feel sure of it. People will find a way to have a pet turtle. The organizations have dramatically made it appear that these turtles are being smuggled out of the country by the thousands, whereas there's not been a recent study in the U.S. to show that they're really depleted. So my biggest comment is, you know, if somebody is concerned that these turtles are being taken out of the wild way too much, let's have a biologist do an estimate, just like we would with deer hunting. Let's impose a quota. Let's not jump to the extreme and make it all illegal. Let's impose a quota on these turtles and allow the people that farm-raise them continue to farm-raise them and sell their offspring. Right now, this proposal would make it illegal to sell those offspring.
But you're not, you don't understand the proposed rule to ban somebody from having a pet turtle that they've collected on their property, do you?
Well, I believe the proposal states that you can give a turtle to somebody, but you cannot sell it to them. Okay. And I don't think they're allowed to have that turtle for breeding purposes. So that means if I wanted to have the ability and the excitement of having two turtles come together and lay eggs and hatch those eggs and see the circle of life and see the babies produced, it stops that.
Well, that's not my understanding of the proposal, but am I correct that would not, but that use would not be precluded?
But Meredith, if you want to speak to that directly, please.
No, the proposed rule would not prohibit commercial breeding of turtles as long as the brood stock was obtained properly from permitted dealers, maybe an out-of-state source. That could still happen. And no, it would not be illegal for people to have pet turtles, nor for them to have pet turtles in their possession that breed. They just can't sell the offspring.
Okay. Thank you for your clarification. Thank you, Mr. McNabb. All right. Mike Forstner, followed by Kevin Seiler.
Commissioners, Chairman Carter. I am Michael Forstner. I'm a Regents Professor at Texas State University, and it was both my privilege and my onus to lead some of the research teams that were presented in Meredith's PowerPoint. Really, I'm here this morning to promote two thoughts that came from those papers. These are peer-reviewed articles that were all published within the last 8 years. One of those papers clearly demonstrates that in South Texas, unregulated commercial harvest of red-eared sliders resulted in a change in those populations that was statistically significant 20 years later. That is, it negatively impacted the number of individuals in the wild in three Texas counties after commercial harvest had occurred 20 years prior. And we did extensive testing to make sure that that was the proximal cause, not a correlation to development. And then, in a second study that we examined exports of wild-caught commercial harvested turtles and looked at how those regulations influence what happens on the market. And I would argue that I'm here this morning in case there were questions that were relevant from any of you, and that those two papers substantiate, alongside six others, my support of the proposal that's before you for the rule changes.
Thank you, Professor. All right, Kevin Seiler with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, followed by Dr. Nazer.
Good morning. I'm Kevin Seiler. I'm a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the Southwest region here in Texas. So for your consideration, I want to tell you a little bit about our recent observations, provide some examples of criminal investigations that have occurred recently, and then comment briefly on the relationship between policy and law enforcement. So in the last 3 to 5 years, we've observed some significant illegal commercial trafficking of turtles and tortoises nationwide, and affecting Texas as well. Species include all manner of terrapins and tortoises. From what we've seen, the illegal collection in the wild has had no regard for size, sex, or age of the animals. They're all collected, they all hold value on the black market, and they've all been intercepted or otherwise investigated in illegal interstate commerce and in foreign commerce. So most recently, we've had an investigation that came to a conclusion with 5 convictions for the illegal poaching of alligator snapping turtles out of Texas. They were then taken to Louisiana, where they were commercialized. And from that point, they went into mostly interstate commerce, but also potentially foreign commerce as well from that location. And I've provided some photos. The primary reason that we had the poachers come into Texas is because their old collection grounds in Louisiana had been fished out. And that was according to their observations and what information they gave us, which was corroborated during the investigation as well. So they did some really significant damage to Texas, southeast Texas, removing very large, very old alligator snapping turtles. And in the process, would also collect anything else that would generate any kind of income. So next we had a terrapin trafficker who also dealt specifically in box turtles. Collected them illegally in Louisiana, did some extreme damage there. Commercial commercially transported many of these animals into Texas and also to the east and west coast. These turtles did end up getting exported, smuggled out to China and Hong Kong and other locations overseas as well. And specifically, this subject contacted an undercover agent with the Fish and Wildlife Service and was attempting to move into Texas to start collecting in Texas illegally because Louisiana had been tapped out, essentially, of the species. So also on the Sabine River, some fishermen were found on the Texas side of the Sabine River. They were illegally netting terrapins of every species. And these were intended to be taken back into Louisiana, and then they were all earmarked for smuggling to China. Indications were they had done this on multiple occasions in the past, but they were intercepted at that time. We believe there's still more going on. So another subject who was convicted of smuggling wildlife into Texas from overseas was also dealing in the illegal interstate commerce of reptiles, including venomous snakes and turtles and tortoises specifically in interstate commerce as well. And when we served the search warrant primarily for illegal wildlife that had been smuggled into the United States from overseas, we also discovered he was in possession of numerous tortoises. Some were endangered, and the tortoises also included Texas tortoises. So in general, I can say that, you know, policies that provide exceptions to general prohibitions, such as commercial prohibitions, when the exceptions start piling up, it becomes more and more difficult to effectively enforce the law. So if you can commercialize a species, say that if you collect only from a specific area, and those are okay to commercialize, well then every animal that we come across during an investigation will be proclaimed to be from that area, even if the science doesn't back it up. But ultimately, whenever there's a question like that that can't be absolutely settled for each individual animal that we have as evidence, prosecutors, at least in the federal courts, generally will not deal with it, and enforcement becomes ineffective at that point. So that concludes my comments. I do have some photos from the cases I described.
I'll tell you what, if you just drop those off, Commissioner Geller, she'll pass them around so all the commissioners they can see them, and then I'll get them back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Seiler, for your for coming today and for your sharing your thoughts on this. Okay, Dr. Nazer, followed by Evelyn Mertz.
Yes, hello. My name is Dr. Craig Nazer, and I have a long experience with turtles. I've been a turtle lover all my life, and I've lived in New York City, Louisiana, and Texas, and every place I've always had turtles as pets. And here in Austin, I've known a lot of people who breed turtles. And in all that experience, I've raised snapping turtles, I've raised soft-shell turtles, and I've raised red ear sliders. And in all that time, I have never known anyone to raise particularly snapping turtles and soft-shell turtles as pets or as food. They raise them as pets maybe, but not as a food source because it's just too expensive. Soft-shell turtles and particularly snapping turtles grow very slowly. And You have to feed them constantly. And there's just no way you can raise these animals cheap enough to sell for the prices that they're selling for meat. Now, I know in New York City, when I lived in New York City, people used to buy Florida soft-shell turtles at the Chinese market, and you'd see them on the subway with these big live turtles in a bag, which was horrendous to me. So I went out, and I got back then a little baby Florida soft-shell, raised it, and it took, it was a female. It took like 10 years to get her to a decent size. Now she's in the Monroe Zoo. And she's huge because it's the biggest species of soft shell. But I don't see how you could possibly raise that and make any money off it for what they're selling, collecting them for and selling them for now, which is mostly for food. Also, that snapping turtle, the common snapping turtle, this is a very beneficial animal. People think that snapping turtles eat fish. They eat very little fish. What I see them in Austin, I have a lot of observations of them in Austin and parks, is they come up the creeks into the ponds right below the stormwater drains. These big females, and they'll sit in there, and they'll just sit in there, and they'll wait for a big storm, and they eat everything that washes down the stormwater. I've seen them eat dead cats that were killed on the road and washed down. They eat all the earthworms, everything. When you look at a stormwater drain, what comes down in a big storm, and they stuff themselves in between waiting for the rains, I've watched them. They eat insect larvae. These are ponds with no fish in them. And I've seen big snapping turtles just going around, just eating like that, eating insect larvae. That's a good thing. That's a very good thing. And they live in city ecosystems. They come up into places that are, they're sometimes very dirty. I think these are very important animals to have. And I think if you take too many of them out of the ecosystem, it does real damage. And I strongly support this. And I know the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club strongly supports you passing this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Nazer. Evelyn Mertz, followed by Romy Swanson.
I'll make this quick since, by the way, good morning. My name is Evelyn Mertz. I'm the conservation chair of the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club, representing them today. We submitted our comments in favor of this proposal online. I do want to correct a mistake I unfortunately made. I noted the Florida soft shell, which was wrong. It should have been the smooth soft shell, so I want to correct that. The other thing is I'm just going to highlight one particular part of our written comments, which I think is very important. And that is that as important as I hope what you're going to do here today is, enforcement is going to be the key. Louisiana has relatively lax turtle rules, as you've already heard today, and we mentioned that in our written comments. And so there's going to be an incentive for people to basically poach turtles in East Texas and cart them across the state border to be exported from Louisiana. And for that reason, we really hope that strong enforcement and actually encouragement of the Louisiana Department of Wildlife Fisheries by their colleagues, hopefully here in Texas, as well as the commissioners who might have relationships with some of your counterparts in the state of Louisiana, would be to try to encourage them to adopt their own rules to promote sustainable populations in Louisiana and reduce the pressure, illegal pressure in our state. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Romy Swanson with Audubon, Texas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Romy Swanson. I'm a certified wildlife biologist and the Director of Conservation Strategy with Audubon, Texas. First, I would like to express my appreciation to the department staff in reviewing the broad scope of available scientific and market data. Meredith, thank you to you and your team. Next, I'll outline the rationale for supporting these rule changes. Number one, the rule changes will serve as a proactive protection from the potential of unsustainable commercial exploitation. Although reported commercial harvest appears negligible through recent years in Texas, it is undeniable that a global market exists. We have seen concerning We have seen concerning natural resources in Texas that it becomes exceedingly difficult to enact meaningful protections in the face of a rapidly emerging industry or market. And these rule changes will safeguard us from that difficult scenario playing out. Number two, these rule changes will help law enforcement. It will remove the burden on wardens to recognize the often discreet differences between similar-looking species like red-eared slider and Rio Grande cooter, one being a widely distributed and very common species throughout most of the state, the other being an imperiled species of greatest conservation need limited to the greater Rio Grande River watershed. As written now, the current rules can only be adequately enforced by wardens and law enforcement that are sufficiently trained and familiar with the full depth and breadth of turtle diversity within the state of Texas. Law enforcement will benefit from a set of rules that governs all turtles evenly. Lastly, the proposed rule changes affirm the principles of the North American model of wildlife conservation. Wildlife are a public trust asset managed for the people of the state. And although this public trust principle has deep origins in common law, it is important to point out that this is affirmed in statute through Texas Parks and Wildlife Code and our own Texas Constitution. Another principle of the North American model is the elimination or extreme regulation of wildlife markets, as we see in the fur bearers trade. The elimination of wildlife markets was originally established as a principle from concern over the catastrophic exploitation of game animals and non-game birds. However, it is now applied to wildlife evenly and effectively prevents the population declines that we see through market activities and assures protection of public trust resources from privatization. I thank you for your time and happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak on item three? All right. Does the commissioner want to make a motion with respect to this?
I move approval.
There's motion by Commissioner Jones, second Commissioner Scott. All in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, item three carries. Action item four, Gulf Shrimp Unloading License, Replacement License Rules. Mr. Lance Robbins.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. For the record, my name is Lance Robinson with the Coastal Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to bring before you a proposed action item that would create a replacement license for an offload shrimp license that was recently created by the Texas legislature during the last session. House Bill 1260 created this new license that allows federally permitted commercial shrimp boats to offload and unload and sell product in the state of Texas. The price for that license was set by the legislature at the same price of a non-resident license. And, of course, the Parks and Wildlife Code allows the commission to establish a replacement license in the event that the original license was lost, that we currently have replacement licenses in place for the six other commercial fisheries that operate in coastal waters of Texas. The public comments that we received thus far, and as of yesterday, we had 16 support and 4 in opposition. Those in opposition, 2 of them were just opposed to any new regulation created by Parks and Wildlife. And then the other ones really spoke to the fact that there were concerns that creating this offload license, or that was already created, but the replacement license would create have an impact on value of shrimp coming into Texas, fuel and dockage prices. They just felt that would increase competition to local fishermen. So with that, we have the following recommendation that I will read into the record. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts the amendment to 53.12 concerning commercial fishing licenses and tags with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the July 20th, 2018 issue of the Texas Register.
Thank you, Lance. Is there anybody who wishes to speak in connection with this item? All right. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Latimer. Second, Commissioner Jones. All in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, item four carries. Okay, action item five, air gun and arrow gun rules and hunter education for air guns and arrow guns. recommended adoption of proposed changes, 25-year employee Clayton Wolf.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. As a brief point of departure, my name is Clayton Wolf, for the record. As a brief point of departure, and no, Mr. Smith, this is not to try to refute anything you said earlier, but I just wanted to folks should have noticed the bighorn sheep mount outside, the full body mount out there. If you haven't, if you would just take a moment to take a look at that and read the little placard, I think you probably recall Froilan Hernandez talking about our sheep restoration program, the fact that sheep had been extirpated, restored, and of course any harvest of a bighorn sheep ram in Texas is a celebration of our conservation success. That particular ram is particularly special. It was the first harvest after our restoration program by Mr. David Abbey. Mr. Abbey recently passed away, and we had a gentleman that became aware of this and worked with his wife, and she, Miss Abbey, was gracious enough to donate that sheep to us, so we feel very fortunate to have that sheep with us. So we probably won't keep it out here in the lobby, because when the Smith School children come over, we don't want them to pluck every hair off the off of it. So we'll put it somewhere else. So I just ask you if you could take a moment to take a look at that. We're very proud that Miss Abbey donated that to us, and we're going to hang on to it here to celebrate our success in the sheep restoration program. Now to the business at hand, of course, I'm here this morning to ask for your consideration in adopting regulation changes related to big bore air rifles, also some archery equipment standards. As I indicated yesterday, you've been briefed on these several times, and so I'm not going to go back into a lot of the detail that I covered on big bore air rifles and arrow guns, except to say that the impetus for this regulation proposal was from a petition for rulemaking from Crossman Corporation. And also we all had some interest from other air gun enthusiasts. So we came to you with a proposal. And just briefly, in March, that proposal basically would have required a minimum 30 caliber minimum, but really no other minimum requirements for the take of big game animals. We took some direction from the commission, came back in May with some other additional requirements to include that these devices would be precharged pneumatics and at least 140 grain bullet. We got some more guidance from the commission, really asking us to focus in on muzzle energy requirements, either directly or those factors that contribute to that. And so in July, we pulled down the proposals that we had at the Texas Register and published new changes new changes and also previously approved changes. And as I mentioned yesterday, when we pulled those three sections down, it also included some items that had been previously approved by or presented to this commission, but they too had to be pulled down. And so I want to make sure that everyone understands in this particular adoption this morning, we have components other than, we have certain elements that are not related to air rifles as well. I will cover those briefly. So one of those is just the definition of an air gun. We took some direction from this commission in March and refined that definition. And so since January, we took some direction in January, and since March, that definition has not changed. We presented to you a repeal of certain archery equipment standards to include those related to the width of broadhead hunting points and also that they should have two minimum cutting edges. We're also asking you to repeal the requirements that crossbows have a minimum of 125-pound pull and that the crossbow stock not be not less than 25 inches. You may recall that that Archery Trade Association had done a survey of the states, and their particular purpose here was try to look at the complexity of archery regulations, try to simplify those and see if the states could standardize to the greatest degree possible so that these regulations are not a barrier to the introduction of folks into archery. In May, we introduced the term arrow gun. We had been previously using the term air bow, and so that definition we presented to you in May has remained unchanged. And we also introduced the term precharged pneumatic. The one new requirement within this proposal we were asking you to adopt this morning is the requirement for hunter education. Right now, the current hunter education requirements only apply to firearms and archery equipment. These pneumatic devices are neither firearms nor archery equipment, and so we clearly would like our hunters out there that are hunting to be required to have hunter education irrespective of the device. And so to the meat of the proposal, for the take of big game species, alligators and turkeys, we have proposed that these big bore air rifles be pre-charged pneumatics only, be a minimum of 30 caliber. Also that they would fire a minimum of 150 grain bullet at 800 feet per second or higher, or any bullet weight and muzzle velocity combination that would generate at least 215 foot-pounds of energy. That third metric there of the 150 grain bullet and 800 feet per second, if you're spot on with those metrics, that equates to 213 foot-pounds of energy at the muzzle. And then for fur bearers, the proposal would be that these air rifles be pre-charged pneumatics only, minimum of 30 caliber. And then for the small game species, squirrels, chachalaca, quail, and pheasant, the minimum in the proposal is a 177 caliber, 600 feet per second. Muzzle velocity minimum. The point to be made here is the proposal is for small game would not include the pre-charged pneumatic because some of these breakover type air rifles and air rifles that can be pumped up can generate at least 600 feet per second, and that is sufficient to humanely harvest these small game species. The public comment didn't change much from yesterday. We have 118 that agree totally with the proposal, 18 that disagree completely with the proposal, and today we have 12 that disagree on specific components. That's one up from yesterday. I believe you have been provided with a letter from Velocity Outdoor, formerly known as Crossman Corporation, so that's the one other comment we received since yesterday, and their specific recommendation is that the minimum metric should be 35 caliber in a pre-charged pneumatic. Reasons for folks completely disagreeing with the proposal for game animals is simply these big bore air rifles are not needed. Some felt that they would increase poaching. Specific reasons for disagreement, some just felt the metrics, the muzzle energy requirements are too low. Some felt they were too high. That these devices are not big enough, are not sufficient for big game species. And then we also received comments that the rules are too complicated or unenforceable. On fur bearers, we had fewer comments. No changes since yesterday. 42 agree, 10 disagree completely, and 3 disagree on specific aspects of the proposed rule. Those that disagree completely believe that these devices will increase wounding loss or increase poaching. And then some of the comments for specific disagreement included one person that opposed the mandatory hunter education. Folks felt that these pneumatics should be for small game only. And then we had one recommendation that the minimum caliber size for fur bearers should be either 22 or 25 caliber. So the motion that we're asking you to consider this morning is the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts amendments to Section 65.3 and 65.11 concerning the statewide hunting proclamation and an amendment to Section 65.375 concerning the statewide fur-bearing animal proclamation with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the July 20th, 2018 issue of the Texas Register. That completes my presentation. I'll be happy to take any questions or step aside if there is anybody making public comment.
I have a couple of questions for you. You mentioned that after this proposal was first made by you and your team that it was discovered that the term firearms created some challenges because of the fact that these air guns are not considered firearms. Maybe it's a question for you, Bob, but have we made sure that there aren't other regulations where the term firearm is there and somehow the regulation should apply to an air gun and needs to be, the definition in the particular regulation needs to be expanded. I just want to make sure we've kind of cross-checked, are there other existing rules that may need to be modified, like the hunter education rule?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your question. I'm not aware of any situation where this would be a problem, but I think it would be prudent to do that comprehensive check, and I'm not aware that we've done that.
Yeah, let's do that to make sure that we don't have a gap, if you will, assuming this proposal
right,
passes.
There's not some loophole where this would be problematic in the way it would have been had we not caught the question about hunter education.
Yes, so would you do that?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. And then the second thing, you just said, Clayton, that Crossman, I think he's whatever Crossman's now known as, Crossman was the petitioner here.
That's
in the
correct.
First instance.
That's correct.
And it's now saying that the proposal should be for a minimum of 35 caliber instead of 30, which...
That's correct. There, just a little history. When we were working with Mr. King... at the time, and maybe he can speak to this, the general recommendation of industry, if there were any, was a 35 caliber PCP. When we visited with Mr. King, we asked him if our 30 caliber minimum was going to create any kind of issue with that, and my recollection was it would not. So there was a general recommendation that the minimum be 35 caliber. From the air gun industry and a PCP. I do have some stats on other states. Some are here in front of me. And, you know, it does vary. There are, out of the 11 or 12 states that are out there, there are some that have no minimum caliber if they allow for large bore air rifles. 35 caliber and 40 caliber are two of the most common minimum size, so there is some variability, anywhere from none to 30 to 35 to 40. And Alabama does have a 30 caliber minimum.
Are you okay if the proposal is up to given that the petitioner is suggesting it be and is a manufacturer of these guns, that it be a minimum of 35 caliber?
Mr. Chairman, my thought is if the commission wants to stick with the energy requirement, I believe that really that will address this issue of wounding loss, irrespective of the diameter, because it's that energy that projectile carries. It's the weight times velocity, irrespective of the diameter of the projectile. So I believe with the 30 caliber, we would allow for more of those models that are out there on the market that can and there are some 30 calibers out there that can generate well over the 215 pound minimum. So my suggestion would be to stay with the 30 caliber and as long as the commission is going to stick with a minimum muzzle energy requirement.
But isn't Crossman aware that the proposal has a minimum muzzle energy requirement?
They are, and their most common commonly sold model, the Bulldog, does not generate that, at least with the fact coming off the factory line. And so I am told that's one of the more popular models that's sold out there in the U.S. And at least coming off the factory, it can't generate, it's I think around 207, 208 feet per second is what their letter says. In other words, if you kept the 35 caliber minimum, but you also kept the 215, it still would the Bulldog coming off the factory line still would not meet the requirements. So what their recommendation is a 35 caliber minimum PCP with no minimum muzzle energy.
Okay, I didn't understand that. That makes a difference. Thank you. All right, anybody else questions or comments? Thank you. We have one gentleman signed up to speak, Mitch King with Air Gun Sporting Association. Welcome, Mr. King.
Thank you. My name is Mitch King. I am the president of the Air Gun Sporting Association. Director Smith, Chairman Duggins, commissioners, I appreciate this opportunity to talk, and I really appreciate the opportunity that you provided help facilitate the opportunity for the industry and the agency to dialogue on this effort. I think it's really important when we all get together, talk through things, whether we end up in full agreement or not, regardless, we fully understand where you're coming from. And as you heard Clayton talk earlier, the position of the industry has been and continues to be that we feel like a 35 caliber PCP air gun is adequate to effectively and ethically take an animal, given hunter responsibility requirements of understanding their equipment. And to that hunter responsibility requirements, you heard Clayton yesterday talk about some of the information that Alan Kane, your Alan Kane, has put together that will be on your webpage. We really support that. I think it was a great piece of work, and we're going to push that out on our websites, and I'm going to work with our industry manufacturers to make sure that that information that Alan pulled together and the dialogue that he put on paper be part of the packaging efforts for our equipment. Hunter education is another big piece of the puzzle. You heard Clayton talk about that. We're fully supportive of that, and we've started a dialogue with the International Hunter Education Association to try to make sure that that air guns are incorporated into hunter education programs, because we think that's extremely important for people to understand what they're shooting, and so that's important to us. Again, as I mentioned, we think 35 caliber PCP is good. Your all's recommendation of 215 does eliminate all but just one, as I think, mass-produced 35 or 30 caliber weapons out there that folks might use. If it was a little bit lower, it would incorporate. I heard the discussion about Velocity Outdoors Crossman and their Bulldog. I think their Bulldog right now, they recommend 145 grain bullet, and they push about almost 800 feet per second with that, and roughly the numbers figure out to be about 207 or 8 foot-pounds of energy. And so if you dropped it down a little bit, that might help bring in one more piece of equipment out there that's available. And I can certainly speak to that more if you have questions. The big point, and the point I made in Lubbock, Texas, when I spoke to you all then, is regardless of what you all decide, the air gun industry is committed to working with the State Wildlife Agency to fully implement whatever it is. We'll be working. We recognize that foot-pounds of energy and feet per second are problematic when you're talking about enforcement. We'll be working to try to help in any way we can with that, and I'll be working with Clayton and others to do that. So, I just want to give a last special thanks to Carter Smith, Clayton Wolf, Alan Kane for all the work that they've done to help bring the industry into this dialogue, and look forward to any questions you might have. Otherwise, thank you very much. And I want to emphasize, we will support your position, whatever comes out.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King, for your remarks, and also for the effort that you put into this dialogue, if you will, about making sure we have an adequate minimum size on this. Thank you so
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Scott, second. Commissioner Jones, all in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Action item 6, rules for special events at Texas Parks and Wildlife Department facilities. Rodney Franklin. Welcome, Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith. For the record, my name is Rodney Franklin. I'm the Deputy Director of State Parks, and I'm here today to propose an amendment to our state park rules and regulations as it relates to alcohol usage in our state parks. For a reminder for y'all, it is an offense currently to publicly consume or display alcohol in public inside a state park. It's also prohibited to sell alcoholic beverages within a state park. So the proposal today would have a few exceptions, would propose a few exceptions to that rule. First being the consumption of alcohol at special events authorized by the executive director would be approved. Consumption of alcohol by concession contractor within specific areas as authorized by the executive director would also be approved. and, of course, the sale of alcohol by concessionaires as authorized by contractor special events would also be authorized. So the reasons we're asking for this change, one of the first reasons is that we feel like it would facilitate using parks as venues for fundraising events that could ultimately benefit Texas Parks and Wildlife and state parks. We have some partners that request that from time to time, and we think that state parks could be a venue for that, and this rule change would facilitate the use of state parks in that scenario. We also have a handful of restaurant, concessionaire restaurant facilities around the state. One that comes to mind is Lone Star Lodge up at Ray Roberts Lake State Park. They have a restaurant there in the lodge. They serve state dinners and meals. We believe that this rule change would enhance the viability and success of those concessionaire operators where they could serve alcohol with their state dinner. So we believe that this rule would help that instance as well. So a few things about what's not changing with this rule. Unauthorized consumption in public areas, it will still be prohibited. People will not be able to drink alcohol on trails or in day use areas or in the campsites just openly. Package sales of alcohol will not be allowed in state parks as well. And of course, with this one and any of our special events and contracts, any activity that goes against the Texas Parks and Wildlife mission or that is in conflict with our values and mission would not be authorized by this. So a few conditions that would exist with this proposal. Consumption will be in areas and times authorized by the concession agreement or the contract. That will be spelled out in the contract and those areas clearly defined. And then also the concessionaire, of course, will have to comply with all state, local laws, including permits and licenses. And I'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. Some of the contract terms that will be included in the contract, for sure, we're going to be concerned with public safety first and foremost. So there are going to be times when safety and security requirements will be put on the onus of the actual concessionaire, and they will be required to handle that. And, of course, our state park police officers will supplement, as they always have, to ensure public safety. Also, a term that will be included in each of these contracts will be proof of liability insurance. And, of course, at the behest of the chairman, we will include liquor liability insurance coverage in all of the contracts where alcohol is involved. The specific area where the consumption is approved will be outlined specifically in the contract. And also, just to be clear, we will not authorize the removal of alcohol from that designated area to other areas of the park. So there will be no spillover of consumption of alcohol outside the designated area as outlined in the contract. And then any other terms or operational issues or concerns will also be outlined in the contract as well that might be site-specific. So to date, we've had 51 comments regarding the rule change. We checked that this morning, and that has not changed. We have 32 that were in favor of the rule. I believe we heard from one yesterday, 19 opposed. The comments, we had about 10 comments on the website. All of these comments were on the website, by the way. The 10 comments were regard to visitor safety and concern that people would be drinking on trails and in the day use areas. And as I mentioned earlier, that activity will still be prohibited. We will outline that by contract, and our state park peace officers will take care of anything that's in violation of that. So this is not an open consumption of alcohol in all areas. It will be designated and defined. So our visitor safety concerns that were mentioned here, we feel like we will take care of those. So with that, we recommend adoption of the following motion. Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt amendment to the Texas Administrative Code 59-134 with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the July 20th, 2018 issue of the Texas Register.
Commissioners, any questions of Rodney?
Rodney, would it still be prohibited for commissioners to drive around the park throwing beer bottles out the window at the signs and the in the various locations across Texas?
Well, the change hadn't been approved yet, so there's still opportunity to make changes if you want to recommend that. But yes, that would still be prohibited currently.
Just asking for a friend.
Understood.
And for the record, those comments were made in jest. Sorry. On a serious note, on the fourth bullet point, other terms as appropriate, I know we're going to have each of these agreements will be reviewed by the legal team. I just suggest that we ought to, as a matter of policy, require the user to indemnify the department and the department's employees for any claims related to or arising out of the consumption of alcohol. It's a thought.
Absolutely.
Okay. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Lee, for motion. Commissioner second. Scott, second. All in favor? Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Thank you, Rodney. Action item 7, acquisition of land, Marion County, 2 acres at the Caddo Lake Wildlife Management Area. Stan David. Welcome, Stan.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, Stan David with Land Conservation Program. This agenda item is concerning the acquisition of land in Marion County adjacent to the Caddo Lake Wildlife Management Area for 2 acres. It's very northeast Texas. It's close to 20 miles northeast of Marshall, Texas. Caddo Lake WMA consists of almost 7,000 acres in Marion and Harrison counties. It's located 20 miles east of a little pretty town of Jefferson, Texas. The state acquired the core of the WMA in 92. In 1993, Caddo Lake was selected as a wetland of international importance, especially for waterfowl habitat under the Ramsar Convention. Today, the WMA is a very popular northeast Texas destination for wildlife viewing, hunting, and fishing. The subject 2-acre tract is sharing 420-foot of boundary in common with the WMA. Access to this parcel of land is from FM 805 through a lot gate. TPWD controls the lot gate. It's got a map I'll show you. Right now, this private landowner keys the gate, goes 500 foot inside the WMA before they get to their driveway. Acquisition of this tract of land will address several issues for the WMA operations, including public hunting and managing access. Existing infrastructure on the property will be modified and used for WMA purposes. There's a water well, electricity, septic system on there. It could support an office trailer or a small bunkhouse. Tract is located very west side of the WMA. It's outlined in yellow there. You see as you enter the WMA, there's a parking area on the right. You would turn right, go south inside the WMA to get to the subject tract there. We received 20 comments. All are in support for the acquisition. And the staff recommends the Texas Park and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to acquire approximately 2 acres in Marion County for addition to Caddo Lake WMA. I'll answer any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you, Stan. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Latimer, second. Commissioner Scott, Jones, beg your pardon. All in favor? Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Action item 8, exchange of land, Washington County, Washington on the Brazos State Historic Site. Trey Vick, welcome, Trey.
Good morning, Commissioners, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Trey Vick. I'm with Land Conservation Program. Today, I'm presenting an exchange of land in Washington County. It's approximately 1 acre at Washington on the Brazos. Washington on the Brazos in Washington County sits about 7 miles southeast of a small town in Navasota. Washington on the Brazos State Historic Site sits along the Brazos River. 59 delegates met there to make formal declarations of independence from Mexico in March of 1836. The original 50-acre site was acquired by the state in 1916 to preserve the original Washington town site. Today, the site consists of about 300 acres, includes Independence Hall, Star of the Republic Museum, and the Barrington Living History Farm. It's been a goal of the park to acquire more property at the entrance. The commission approved an acquisition for a four-acre tract adjacent to the entrance that would help protect the entrance and provide space for improvements. Before we acquire the four-acre tract, we need to do a land swap or an exchange of approximately one-acre tract to make this four-acre tract contiguous with the park. The owner of the adjacent one-acre tract is willing to exchange his tract for 1 acre out of the 4 acres. As you can see here, the 4 acre acquisition that was approved is outlined in yellow. This is a conceptual map of what we think the exchange could look like. However, I would ask the commission for a little bit of latitude as we negotiate for, you know, if it ends up being half acre, if it ends up being 1.5 acres, 2 acres, just some latitude there on the size and shape. After both acquisitions are complete, this gives you an idea of what the final boundary would look like at the entrance, outlined in red. We received 40 comments, 38 in support, 2 in opposition. And if you have no questions, staff recommends the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The commission adopts the resolution attached as Exhibit A. Yes, sir. That's the 4 acre tract, and I separated out the two swaths. So
that's what it looks like after the proposed swap.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that 2 acres is taken off of the backside of the old acreage, or the
correct
right acre, or whatever it is.
Yeah, we would swap about an acre on the far south property line for an acre adjacent to the park that's outlined in red there.
Got it.
So afterwards it would resemble this.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, what exactly does the resolution say? I don't see it in the book. Oh, sorry, I was looking for an Exhibit A. It's I withdraw that. I was looking for a specific Exhibit A. Sorry. All right. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Lee?
Second.
Second. Commissioner Galo? All in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. As I said earlier, item 9 is withdrawn, so we'll take us to 10. Transfer of land, Walker County, 0.60 acres at Huntsville State Park. Trey?
Yes, sir. Again, for the record, my name is Trey Vick. I'm with Land Conservation Program. This item is a transfer of land at Huntsville State Park in Walker County of approximately 0.6 of an acre. Huntsville State Park is in Walker County. Sits about 6 miles south of Huntsville. Huntsville State Park is 2,000 acres, is located in Walker County deep in the southeast Texas Piney Woods. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department has been approached by the city of Huntsville for a transfer of approximately 0.6 acres of parkland to an adjacent landowner. An area of approximately 500 by 40 is requested for public waterline and sewer lift station improvements. The requested location is about 3/4 of a mile from the main body of the park. It is not used by the public and is disturbed by previous clearing and earthwork. In exchange for this land transfer, the developer of the land surrounding Huntsville State Park has agreed to an enforceable deed restriction of 25-foot no-clear natural buffer along approximately 5 miles of park boundary to protect the park. Now, this equates to about 16 acres. Here's a map showing the proposed location. Here's a close-up map of the 0.6 acres. And here is just an outline of what we would receive in exchange, the 25-foot buffer along the 5 miles of boundary. Public comments, we received 50 comments total, 30 in support, 20 in opposition. Staff recommends Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The commission adopts the resolution attached as Exhibit A. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why can't we, instead of transferring fee title, have them give them a long-term lease or a lease that remains in effect to so long as these utility infrastructures are in place and in use?
The city has requested a fee simple transfer.
Well, I understand the city wants that, but what if 10 years from now it's not used for this utility infrastructure?
Well, it's my understanding that we're only allowed to grant term easements, and the city will not operate with a term easement.
Well, Bob's out of the room. Ann, could you help us understand why we should convey fee simple title when it's... when the, at least the Exhibit A says Huntsville desires to construct additional utility infrastructure on the land for which the easement was granted?
I mean, I suppose that that's something that we could try to negotiate with the city, but, you know, just to clarify, this is something, is an agency that we've traditionally really wanted, which is we want to... because it's just so much cheaper, oftentimes, not completely, to tie into a municipality's water and wastewater system. I suspect we also don't want to have any responsibility for this property anymore. I mean, I think that that's the other thing that's probably going to be an issue. I'm going to let Ted talk about some of the practical issues.
Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. We have been discussing this dynamic for utility improvement and development adjacent to the park for a year now. And our initial offer to them was a long-term easement. We even offered to come to the commission and attempt to negotiate a 99-year easement, a very, very long-term easement. And they made it pretty clear that from their perspective that was a deal killer. They need to have fee simple or fee ownership of the surface so that they can be free to design whatever facilities they need in whatever manner they need to. And they have a three-party relationship with this developer, and nobody wanted to entertain an easement. We explored that and we pushed that pretty hard. And we can go back and push again if that's the direction of the commission, but we have explored that.
Does anything prevent the city from building a three-story structure there?
I'm going to let Trey respond to that. He's been negotiating the terms of the actual easement, and the easement has not been consummated at this point. We can put any restrictions into that. We can put any deed restrictions into that conveyance that the commission directs us to.
Mr. Chairman, I just talked to legal staff and Mr. Smith, and we will see if we can negotiate in a reverter clause on this. So if it ever ceases to be used for the utility and the lift station that's already there, that it reverts back to...
Well, I was about to suggest that, but I also think we should consider, do we want any type of height or light limitation? I mean, I don't understand. I don't know what they mean by utility infrastructure, and I don't know whether that would interfere with the uses of the park, but if you're granting fee simple title with no restriction there.
On this map here, this strip of land here, the park receives its water from the city out of Elkins Lake subdivision, which is there to the north. We purchased this little 50-foot strip several years back strictly for utility run down to the park. The city, where the arrow on the right-hand side of the screen is, they have an existing sewer lift station that serves the park, and that's where the city water heads down to the park. They're wanting to loop their system. They're wanting to improve these utilities that are within this half acre, and that's why they were wanting to beef up the easement. We like to give term easements. The city doesn't want to work with the term easement. They won't.
Chairman, what if we take your direction here and we ask for a reverter clause if the use by which this is contemplated is no longer going to be in existence, and then also we explore any other potential restrictions or encumbrances that would go with the transfer that would ensure the protection of the park? And we're probably not going to be able to figure out all of those right now, but if that's the guidance from you, we can certainly have Trey see what we can get as part of it.
I think that would be the way we should approach it, is to ask Huntsville to, A, give us a reverter. That doesn't hurt them one bit. They use it in perpetuity. They got it in perpetuity. But I do think we should consider, do we want to put any type of deed restriction or something on terms of height, sound, or light?
Sure.
Consider it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I hear that guidance, and let's see what we can do and explore that and talk to our state park staff and see what might be needed or necessary.
Chairman, also, it says it's a no clear buffer zone in that purchase, so that would be a deed restriction?
Yes.
So once they own the property, they couldn't come back and put other utilities in, like power lines or
correct
anything
correct.
Else. Okay, thank you.
And within that buffer zone, we added language in there that it would be enforceable by us if needed by park staff. So we wouldn't be relying on the homeowners association or something like that. Is if we see something along our boundary, we are able to enforce that deed restriction.
Okay. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second. Commissioner Lee, all in favor? Motion carries without opposition.
Thank you.
All right. Item 11, Brewster County, 16,000-acre acquisition at Black Gap. Ted, welcome again.
Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is an item you've heard before. It's a very, I think, a very exciting opportunity to make a very significant addition to our largest wildlife management area, the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area in West Texas. One of the neat things about the wildlife management area and this proposed acquisition is it's a part of a much, much, much larger conservation initiative. This ecosystem, of course, is unique. It includes a couple million acres north of the border and several million acres south of the border. Texas and Mexico have worked together for 15 or 20 years now, actively worked to set aside reserves and state parks and other areas that all contribute to a conservation landscape that now totals about 5 million acres. Again, extremely diverse, extremely important. A number of species occur there that occur nowhere else in the world. A close-up shows the GLO property, the property south of that looks like it may be privately owned, is actually held in by conservation easement by the Nature Conservancy. It's land that's been acquired by CMEX and partners to contribute to this conservation landscape. So this remaining 16,000 acres really is a significant hole in that entire conservation initiative. Again, not going to go into much more detail, but about 7 miles of frontage on the Rio Grande, important corridor and important habitat for black bear, bighorn sheep, trophy class mule deer, and three species of quail, a number of other species that are of interest to the agency.
The status of this potential acquisition is that we are in discussions, pretty specific discussions now with General Land Office about what that transaction would look like. The next step is for us to work out the terms and conditions of a letter of intent that we could then proceed from. We do have an appraiser on deck to begin, with your approval today, to begin the appraisal process for that. And the funding that would be used would be Pittman Robertson dollars, which are federal dollars that are collected anytime someone buys a firearm or ammunition and can only be used for conservation purposes. They flow through our Fund 9 program, our wildlife division, and in terms of acquisition, can only be used to acquire or add to wildlife management areas. As you can see from the pictures, it's some pretty spectacular countryside we're talking about adding to the wildlife management area. As of this morning, we've had 193 comments, all in support. Most of those comments have come from members of the Black Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, but about 35 comments have come from individuals as well. The staff recommends that Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Commission adopt the following motion: that Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to acquire approximately 16,000 acres in Brewster County for addition to the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ted. We have one individual signed up to speak in connection with this matter. It's Todd Basil with the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. So welcome, sir.
Thank you, Commissioners, and thank you, Mr. Hollingsworth, and apologize in advance for having probably blown up your email box there from our membership, but we appreciate you you hearing us out. So obviously I'm here today to express our support for this measure. Just a little background from yesterday on Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or BHA for short. We consider ourselves the sportsman's voice for our wild public lands, waters, and wildlife. We're a nonprofit organization with about 20,000 members nationwide and about 1,000 members so far here in the Lone Star State since our chapter's inception about 3 years ago. BHA is comprised of sportsmen and women that are deeply committed to protecting and enhancing access to our public lands and waters, as well as to promoting wildlife management policies that include quality hunting and fishing opportunities thereon. So needless to say, we strongly support the commission's the proposal to add the 16,000 acres to the Black Gap WMA. Only about 2 to 4%, depending on who you speak with, of Texas is public, and roughly half of that is accessible for hunting and fishing at any given time. It's our understanding that the land will include that 7 miles of frontage on the Rio Grande River with habitat supporting populations of bighorn sheep, black bear, three species of quail, and other Trans-Pecos region wildlife. This is an incredible opportunity to significantly expand our state's public lands, bring this valuable habitat and its wildlife into the public trust, and open new recreational opportunities for all Texans. So should the proposed expansion of the WMA be approved, Texas BHA further encourages Texas Parks and Wildlife to implement responsible wildlife management policies that will include expanded hunting and fishing opportunities for public landowners throughout the state. And I, for one, would love this as well, not just mostly because I didn't draw a tag this year. So, so members of the commission, thank you on behalf of Texas BHA for your consideration, and thank you again for your stewardship of Texas's wildlife and lands.
Thank you, sir. Okay, the draft motion in the book doesn't state that the funding source would be 75% paid by Pittman Robertson funds and the difference a match from raised by the Parks and Wildlife Foundation. I just want to understand or suggest that the motion be tied to that funding source, because the book doesn't say that, and I'm suggesting whoever makes a motion here, let's make it contingent on the third bullet point of your slide entitled acquisition status, which provides how it would be funded. You okay with that?
Absolutely. I don't believe we have any other viable options for takeout without that, those sources.
Nothing suggested to be inappropriate. I just want to make sure we're clear about this isn't a park.
It's in addition to an existing wildlife management area. Right. Yep, you bet. No, if that's your direction, Chairman, we definitely can integrate that in there. I can think of a potential scenario in which there might be some mitigation funds or other sources that might go to play here in small source, but these are going to be the two principal sources that would fund this. And I guess if there's some necessary departure from that, we can come back to the commission.
I would just say if it's anything material, come back. Otherwise, that's fine.
Okay.
Is everybody okay with that? All right. There's a motion by Commissioner Gallo. Second by Commissioner Jones. All in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. All right. That takes us to our last item, which is a briefing item on white nose syndrome. Jonah Evans. Welcome, Jonah.
Thank you, Commissioners, for having me. I realize I'm the last thing before lunch, so I'll try to make this efficient. For the record, my name is Jonah Evans. I'm the state mammalogist for Texas Parks and Wildlife, and as this is the first time for me presenting in front of this body, I will inform you that this position that I'm in oversees conservation and restoration and management of 130 non-game and rare mammals in the state. Today I'll be providing an update on white nose syndrome and the plans that we have in Texas for combating the disease. First, to provide some context, we in Texas have 30 species of bats. This is more than any other state in the country. And bats are extremely long-lived, often having lifespans of 30 to 40 years. And they can be extremely slow to reproduce. One to two offspring a year is pretty much the norm. Also, bats eat many insects, including many significant agricultural pests. At Bracken Bat Cave, just down the road, it's estimated that bats consume on the order of 200 tons of insects a night. That is roughly the equivalent of 50 elephants. And at Old Tunnel State Park, it's been estimated that they consume 120 million moths per night. And this comes with a significant economic impact to the state. It's been estimated by researchers that the benefit to farmers in reduced pesticide needs and in reduced crop damage is on the order of $1.4 billion a year. Nationally, that number rises to $23 billion a year. White nose syndrome was first discovered in New York State in the winter of 2006-2007, and it has since spread rapidly across the United States. We now know it's caused by the fungus Pseudogymnoascus destructans.
Did you say that again?
Yes, sir. Excuse me. From here forth, I will just refer to it as PD or simply the fungus. And to abide, it's Pseudogymnoascus destructans. It is fatal to bats while hibernating. It invades the tissues around the muzzle and on the wing, causing bats to arouse from hibernation to preen and clean off the fungus. These repeated arousals throughout the hibernation system are biologically very expensive. They burn up a lot of calories, causing the bats to either emerge in search of resources and die from exposure to the elements or to just die of starvation in the site. So far, it's estimated to be responsible for the deaths of about 6 million bats in the country, and some highly susceptible species have declined greater than 90% in impacted regions. After the original detection of PD in New York State 11 years ago, the fungus spread towards Texas at a rate of about 200 miles per year. And now that it is in Texas, we expect to see the fungus to continue to spread throughout the state and then head towards the western United States and Mexico. I should point out that we distinguish between the presence of the fungus and the disease itself because it's possible for some bats to carry the fungus and not exhibit signs of the disease. So when you hear me say the fungus, I'm being specific about the fungus, and if you hear me say the disease, I'm being specific about the disease. The disease tends to lag behind the arrival of the fungus a little bit.
We first detected PD in Texas in 2017 in six panhandle counties. Those include Childress, Collingsworth, Cottle, Hardeman, King, and Scurry. And we detected the fungus on cave walls and on ceilings and in three different Texas bat species, the cave myotis, the Townsend's big-eared bat, and the tricolored bat. On the map depicted here, the infected counties are in red, and in gray are other sites where we surveyed for the disease in that year and did not detect it. And these surveys were conducted by Bat Conservation International and Texas A&M University through grants from Texas Parks and Wildlife. This past winter, we observed that the fungus has continued to spread and has now been found in four additional counties, Blanco, Ford, Kendall, and Wheeler. And we also detected it on a new species, the Mexican free-tailed bat, here in Kendall County at Old Tunnel State Park. Again, the surveys were conducted by Bat Conservation International and Texas A&M University with funding from Texas Parks and Wildlife. The detection of PD on a Mexican free-tailed bat was particularly concerning because this enormously abundant species draws large numbers of people to watch nightly emergences at sites such as Congress Avenue Bridge, Bracken Bat Cave, and Old Tunnel State Park. Fortunately for this bat species, they are migratory rather than not being a hibernating species, and so they're not expected to be impacted by the disease. However, because they are in such large numbers and because their enormous distribution depicted on the graphic there, there's a lot of concern that they are going to greatly exacerbate the spread of the disease. So in summary, PD has been detected on four species at 17 sites in 10 Texas counties so far. White nose syndrome, the disease, has not been observed. However, this is to be expected as it usually requires two to 4 years after the arrival of the fungus before you start seeing signs of the disease. So, of the 30 species that we have in Texas, we predict based on hibernation patterns and similarities to susceptible species that there are four species that are very likely at risk from the disease in Texas. And there's seven additional species that may be at risk, but we require additional information to be sure. 19 species are likely of little to no risk from the disease. The tricolored bat is currently our highest priority. It has undergone significant declines outside of Texas, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife was recently petitioned to list the species. After conducting a 90-day review, they found the petition to be substantial, indicating that the listing review process will continue. We began preparing for white nose syndrome to arrive in Texas back in 2012 with the initiation of surveys for the disease with Bat Conservation International in the Panhandle, and we conducted those surveys each year from 2012 to the present. Then in 2015, we began working with Texas Parks and Wildlife to conduct statewide surveys, and so far we've surveyed 389 caves, 197 bridges, and 230 culverts around the state. Through those efforts, we've been able to identify some very high-priority roost sites that we think are good opportunities for potential management. And this last winter, we supported Bat Conservation International in conducting some treatment trials at some sites in the Panhandle. And we have also worked to develop our own plan to conduct treatments in East Texas. Regarding treatments, there's many different ones currently under development. However, disturbance to hibernating bats and impacts on cave species and non-target species is a big concern that has proven to be a significant roadblock to the development of many treatments. However, some treatments have shown promising results, and there's field trials underway around the country. We've recently developed a plan centered around a unique opportunity in East Texas, where we've discovered that 70% of the entire known winter roosting population of the tricolored bat can be found in just 10 culverts. This plan was developed in collaboration with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the U.S. Geological Survey, Texas A&M University, and Kennesaw State University. And the plan utilizes an integrated disease management approach with multiple treatments being applied to combat the fungus at different stages.
And just briefly, those different treatments include high-pressure steam cleaning during the summer when the bats aren't present to eliminate any fungal spores on the surfaces of the site, and then to come back in shortly after that and coat the site with polyethylene glycol. It's a common additive in toothpaste and hand lotion and the primary ingredient in Miralax. Very safe for the use of mammals, but it prevents the fungus from spreading if it is brought into the site. And then finally, during the winter when the bats are present, we would apply an antifungal fog of a substance called Flavorzon or B23 that would help prevent the fungus from really growing on the bats. We submitted this proposal to National Fish and Wildlife Foundation for funding and are planning treatments for this winter. So finally, in the future, we plan to continue to support treatment research in the state where we can. This winter, we hope to continue to survey for the Mexican free-tailed bat population to better understand the prevalence of the disease in that population. We're also looking at conducting surveys in West Texas because there's many species out there that do not hibernate in large hibernacula, they call them, and it's much more difficult to survey for them, so that would require a different style of surveys. And then finally, we're exploring ways to hire a full-time, if not temporary, bat biologist to take on some of these white-nose syndrome and bat-related issues, as I have 100 other mammals on my plate that I'm also supposed to be responsible for. So thank you for listening. I'm happy to take any questions if you have them.
Yeah, I've got – y'all haven't done anything on that James River bat cave yet, the surveys or anything?
I would have to check my notes. It's been a lot of caves that we've surveyed, and it's mostly been through contracts with Texas A&M University. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that directly.
I'm just kind of curious on that one in particular.
I believe we have. The name is familiar, but I don't want to misspeak.
Does your research show that the bats are the primary vector of the spread of this disease, or are there any other vectors that you've discovered?
When you say your research, I'm assuming you mean just anybody. Yeah, so it is assumed that the original arrival of the fungus in North America came through human-assisted spread. There was also a detection in Washington State 2 years ago that was likely a human-assisted spread. However, the disease seems to be doing a great job of spreading on its own kind of progressively. So there have been efforts to reach out to the caving community to encourage decontamination protocols and the like, to encourage people that if you're going into caves, make sure you clean all your gear and avoid spreading the fungal spores to other sites.
Yeah. Well, Jonah, this is obviously very concerning, but thank you for a very good briefing on it, and thank you to you and the other colleagues here, as well as BCI and A&M, for continuing to try to get your arms around the problem and try to come up with solutions. Appreciate that. I would ask that you keep in the back of your calendar, maybe coming back a year from now at the August 2019 meeting, mm-hmm. giving the commission an update on what's happened over the year. If we could do that,
sir,
I think that'd be a good update to have.
I appreciate the opportunity and the interest. Yeah.
You bet. Yeah, we'll plan on that, Chairman. Yep, thanks.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you
again.
All.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Smith, and your last chance.
Yeah, draw it out, Chairman. Let's make this as agonizing as possible.
If we don't end the meeting. Yeah.
That's right. I'm not sure I'm going to adjourn this meeting. Thanks, everybody, for your patience today and everybody's contributions to a good meeting. I declare us adjourned. We've completed our business.